We'll call the February 17th meeting of the Stanislaus County Retirement Board to order. Can we get roll call, please?
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jason Gordo. Mike Lynch.
Here.
Mandeep Dillon.
Here.
Gordon Ford. Joan Clendenin. Sam Sharp. We have a quorum.
Alrighty then. Are there any announcements by any of the board members, or does anyone want to pull anything from the consent calendar?
I see I've been moved to the left. I don't really like that.
As you get older.
I have one announcement. Obviously, you know Mandeep's joining us for the first time today. He's assumed seat two, Maria's old seat. I want to congratulate Mandeep. He garnered 37.5% of the vote, so he was definitely the winner there. And just to let you know, I've worked with Mandeep for a little bit now over the last couple months, and I really enjoy working with him. He's a very smart and astute person, and I believe he's going to add a lot of value to the board. So. Congratulations, Mandy.
Welcome.
Thank
Andy.
You. It was a tough campaign, by the way.
That's enough to win.
A lot of negative.
That's a tough office you work in.
Yeah. Is there a motion on the consent calendar?
Motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Moving on to the next item, Investment Manager Annual Presentation Legato.
We have a conference call line set up. We'll give them a call and they should be on the line ready for you. Sarah, in just one moment, you'll be online with the full board. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. This is Victor Hines at Legato Capital Management. Are we connected to the Stan Sarah board?
Hi, Victor. It's Rick. Yes, you are. You got the.
Hi, Rick.
Hi. How you doing?
I'd like to begin by introducing the team here today at Legato. We're calling you from San Francisco. I'm Victor Hines, CEO and Chief Investment Officer. I'm here today with Adam Lawler, our Director of Investments, and I've also asked Eric Pollack to join us, who's our Chief Financial Officer and also the firm's Chief Compliance Officer. And before beginning, I thought I would just ask to get some time parameters about how long we have to discuss the portfolio with you and answer questions.
Let's shoot for 20 minutes, including Q&A, Victor.
Okay, will do. Let me very quickly go through a bit of a firm overview. So if you turn with me in your materials, and I'm not certain, Rick, if you're going by the same numbering protocol we are, because I know you've got a very large book, but this would be our page 4.
Hey, I think we're in the ballpark.
Beautiful. Just a couple of things to bring to your attention. In July of this past year, the three partners, all of whom are on this call, purchased the limited partner share that was owned by Forward Management. So that was about 34%. So now Legato is 100% owned by its employees. We added one new research analyst since our last discussion, Diana Temhanker, who joins us with a little more than 10 years experience. Scott Ohm, who worked as our product specialist, who was responsible for business development, RFP and RFI, as well as consultant contact for prospective clients, left the firm in January. We don't anticipate replacing him, but we will be, toward the end of the year, adding a senior position that will be working very closely with both the investment committee itself, as well as overseeing certain aspects of our firm. At the same time, we've now outsourced our book production operation. And at Legato, just as a reminder, we're always trying to outsource things that don't represent a core competency of those here. And so we've now done that completely. Our books remain customized. We invite your comments back if anything in the book it presents in a way that you would like to have changed. You should notice no difference. It's just that what was done internally is now being done externally. We send in live feeds and we review everything as we've always done. Moving forward, one new development this year, we are now a signatory to the Principles of Responsible Investing, and you might remember this as ESG, and we fundamentally believe here that going forward, environment, social, and governance issues are going to play an increasingly large role in the evaluation of companies and their stocks and their bonds. And so we thought we'd want to start that early, and so we've become a signatory to the PRI principles. And finally, this last year, we've added an additional account in the small cap growth strategy, the same as the one you've engaged us for. The city of Atlanta joined us a little earlier in 2015. With that, I will stop for a minute. And just to note, there was one typo in the book that I thought I should bring your attention to. It's located in the Verisk presentation, page 13, where it discusses the fee schedules. And the top of the page is total fund investment fee analysis, period ending December 31st, 2015. We lowered the fee on the portfolio a little more than a year ago to 77 basis points. It's reflecting 90 in the document. So just wanted to give a heads up to make that adjustment. With that, I'll stop there and see if there are any questions on the firm.
Can you repeat the person who joined the firm you said had 10 years of experience? What is her role?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you very much. Diana Temhanker is a senior research analyst, and so she will be a part of our investment team, which numbers six.
And she has been here since September, mid-September, and joined us from with a little over 5 years prior to that at Charles Schwab here in San Francisco in their doing manager research.
Thank you.
Great. Great. Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to turn to page six and turn the baton over to Adam to talk a little bit about the portfolio.
Thank you. On page six shows the assets in the strategy. At the end of the year, $82.5 million, up roughly $4.2 million from the previous quarter. On page seven, as you know, or maybe just a quick reminder that we run a multi-manager portfolio, including five different small cap growth strategies with different philosophies and process and style, sub-styles. And listed on page seven are the five managers along with their style and sub-style and the target and current weight in the total portfolio. Without any additional questions, I'll move on to performance. This is the managers have been constant for the last, since the fourth quarter of 2014. We made no changes in the portfolio over the 2015. The two most recent additions in there were AMI Asset Management and Rice Hall James, the two conservative growth managers that replaced River Bridge and Stevens in that portfolio. At this time, we do not anticipate any changes. However, we are constantly reviewing the managers, and in the future that there might be changes, but at this time, no plan changes. On page eight is the performance. For the last quarter, the performance, the portfolio outperformed by roughly 100 basis points net of fees. Over the last 1 year period, slightly lagged by 6 basis points net of fees, and over the 5 and 7 year periods on a net of fee basis were slightly positive to in line, slightly negative since inception, 2 basis points. We're going to go to a little bit later to the different managers that on the show, the whose portfolios helped drive that performance. But I'd like to turn to page 10, which is the peer universe ranks. The last quarter performance in the fourth quarter was a strong performance for us. We ranked in the top quartile of active manager or managers within the eVestment peer ranked universe, and over the 1, 3, and 5, and since inception in the second quartile quartile, across the small cap growth universe. On page 11 is the performance of the total fund as well as the underlying managers. I just want to highlight for the quarter the two managers that really drove performance for the quarter were AMI and Rice Hall James. That was the majority of the outperformance, and the other three managers were below. Over the last 1 year period, three of the five managers outperformed the portfolio, as the aggressive growth managers, Castle Ark and EAM, lagged the benchmark. We see that very consistent with what we expected within conservative growth managers having a better performance, especially in the second half of the year as market volatility increased. On page 12 is the risk statistics for the portfolio since inception. The design of the portfolio is to produce positive alpha as well as taking less risk. Since inception, the portfolio gross of fees has added 1%, but it's taken less risk to do that with a beta of 0.2 in the portfolio. The tracking error of the portfolio is in line with our expectations. Since inception, it's 3. We're targeting between 3 and 5% for the tracking error. Let me stop there to see if there's any questions on performance. Okay. On page 13 is the attribution of the fourth quarter performance. It was driven by strong stock selection, particularly in consumer discretionary and information technology. The portfolio benefited from some strong stock selection in securities such as LifeLock, Stamps.com, and a takeout in Constant Contact. The portfolio did not have a significant, as planned, effects from sector allocations, which we tried to mitigate during our portfolio construction process. On page 14 is the sector allocation, diversified across most of the major sectors. Slight deviations were at the end of the quarter, overweight technology and underweight financials, healthcare, and materials. On page 15 is the portfolio characteristics. Just a couple to highlight. Our weighted average cap is slightly below, but in line with the benchmark. The valuation metrics, price to book, is slightly lower, and the PE ratios are slightly higher. The growth rate on a forward basis is higher, and quality is, as represented by ROE, is in line with the benchmark. Let me stop there to see if there's any questions on the structure of the portfolio.
Hey, Adam. This is Adam, right? This is Rick.
Yeah.
You know, as I look through this and I look at the numbers and the statistics and the risk stats especially, and I look at the history of the fund, it almost seems to me that what we're doing here, and I don't know if this is just a byproduct of your process there, but it almost looks to me like what we're doing here is we're achieving close to benchmark returns but at a lower level of risk. So it almost seems like the bang for our buck that we're getting is on the risk side and not the return side. Any comments?
This is Victor. And my comment would be, that is a perfect observation for this snapshot period in time. And, you know, the challenge for us is when performance is exceedingly strong and we've had periods like that, everything looks then like there's lower risk and there's higher alpha. We went through a very difficult headwind period about a year and a half ago, I think now. And so we find ourselves coming out of that period, and it just so happens now, if you take the snapshot view, you're right. Performance, just above benchmark, net of fees, less risk. Now, in our world, that's a value proposition of sorts. In other words, we'd be terribly concerned internally if our risk was higher than the benchmark and we were at the same level. But what we do is we're looking farther ahead, and we understand it's a long game, and we've just come out of a very difficult period. And if we, one of the things we do to analyze where we are in that period is we look at something that I know your consultant partners look at as well, and it's rolling 12-month excess returns relative to the benchmark itself, which basically is a chart that shows you how is your alpha. Is it growing? Is it falling? And we've just come off a period that probably goes back to the beginning of 2014, middle of 2014, right before we got to the headwind. And if you were to look at the pattern back to when you originally funded the portfolio, we came in right at the tail end of a similar type of difficult period, went into a very strong period for our strategy from 2011 late all the way to the end of 2013, early 2014, then went back negative again to the pattern. Now what we're seeing are positive signs of coming back out of that again. And that, I think, will be strengthened by the fact that we're moving into a new interest rate environment where basically you're starting to see the market price companies, particularly small cap companies, price those companies based on fundamental value measured in many ways by what companies need debt to continue to run their business as opposed to which companies have to borrow to run their business. If you run your own company, you think about it for a minute, you say, am I able to buy my inventory just using existing cash that's coming in from current sales? Or do I have to go to the bank and borrow? Well, if interest rates are rising, those two companies are going to look very, very different, and their values are going to look very, very different. So this is a long way of saying, going forward, we see our strategy again entering a very positive alpha environment, primarily driven by that and other things, and that certainly would be the picture that we're looking at as we go back as far as 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, no, I don't think my comment earlier is such a bad thing. I guess the only thing it's kind of hit me just a second ago. I think we focus so much on return, and we don't really necessarily take a hard look at the risk that goes along with the return.
Right. That's critically important. One of the great shortcomings of peer universes, even though we all look at them and we live and die by them, is peer universes never tell you how much risk you're taking. Right. So I can come in, we can come in and say we're 1,000 basis points over, and, you know, that doesn't tell you anything. You have to ask more questions. You have to say, well, hang on, turn to your consulting partners. What kind of risk is Legato taking to achieve that 1,000 basis points? And based on what they tell you, that will be the thing that determines whether you should be happy or sad about it. So it's a very good question, and it's something we're very mindful of. The final point I'll make is if you think back years ago, before we were engaged, one of the phenomena that occur in small cap portfolios is you have a propensity to have huge swings in outperformance and underperformance. So, if you will, there were many years when San Sara and many other counties in California would go to a single man, what we call a single manager solution. We're going to hire one small cap growth manager. We're going to hire one small cap value manager. And what unfortunately always happens is we buy at the top because, you know, someone brings in five managers. We're not going to bring in managers that are in the bottom quartile, right? We're going to bring in managers that are in the top half, let's say. So let's say they're up 1,000 basis points for 3 years. So you say, let's hop on board, and all of a sudden, there's only one place to go or one direction to go, and it's down. And you can have swings that are 8, 9, different styles and sub-styles together and mitigate those huge extremes up and down that cause you to take pause and say, well, maybe we should get rid of them now. They're down 1,000. Well, that may be the right time, or maybe they're just really out of, their style's out of favor. So we're happy about the portfolio because it mitigates a lot of these big swings. But at the same time, we still have environments where we perform well, environments where we don't perform well, but we're confident that over time you'll continue to see a positive net of the alpha associated with less risk than the benchmark. Sorry, I talked a little bit too long there.
Sorry. I have a question. Did I hear you say that increased interest rates are positive for the portfolio?
Increased interest rates will be a positive to companies that run their business without the need to borrow.
Well, what happens?
Versus companies that do need to borrow.
And the reason for that is our managers and active managers typically favor quality companies, companies with sound balance sheets. And that, you know, the environment in 2014, where it was a pretty strong headwind for us, was, you know, with the biotech rally, you know, a lot of these companies had no earnings, no revenues, and they're up 300-400%. So that environment in a rising interest rate environment is not beneficial to companies, and there'll be some companies that do well, but in overall, companies with quality, with earnings and revenues, typically do better, where fundamentals count.
How would it affect the portfolio if, as Yellen said a few days ago, that they might go into negative interest rate territory?
Well, I think you will have a pause in the what will happen in the market, but keep in mind the long-term view is rates are going to rise, and that's what's driving the behavior you're seeing. There's no one who's questioning at some point rates will need to rise. We don't think, particularly given the recent economic data we got today, that the Fed is going to wind up at the end of the year not having raised rates by at least 50 to 100 basis points still. And so you saw a huge rout in the market, over 10%, gosh, in the last month. But now you're seeing huge constructiveness coming back as some of the real numbers, particularly in manufacturing today, are coming out, and those are having impacts on the Fed. The Fed real, and you're right, that's a valid comment that Yellen is talking about, well, gosh, what if we have to go negative? We just don't see that. And if we did see it, we don't believe that would take us far off our performance. And the reason for that is the long-term trend, no one will argue, is interest rates higher, which is going to favor value, it's going to favor stronger companies versus companies that are forced to borrow in a rising interest rate environment.
And secondly, we're not trying to, the portfolio is, we're not tactically trying to make a call on interest rates. It's typically when fundamentals matter, our managers do typically do better. So in that, when you get a separation between good companies and poor companies, that's when stock selection works at its best.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
Good question.
On page 16, and this has to do with our risk management, and we really construct a portfolio and manage it to have the majority of our risk in the portfolio be driven from stock selection, and to a lesser degree and a residual, the style or the industry exposures. And if you see that on page 16, 79% of our tracking error is driven from stock selection, whereas 8% from style and 13% from industry. And the majority of that industry is being underweight biotech. And on page 17 and 18, that our tracking error, historical tracking error versus the benchmark in range within our what we expected, the 3 to 5% range. And then on page 18 is just another look at how we view our active risks in the portfolio. 78% of the tracking error coming from stock specific, and the majority, or the lesser extent, from style and industry.
We'd like to stop there. We've gone a little bit more than 20 minutes. We are happy to talk about each individual manager in great detail, but we want to be certainly deferential to the board and the consulting team and ask. Our official remarks are over, but we're certainly here to answer any questions and talk about specific managers if you like.
I've noticed that the financials sector in each of the managers is down significantly. Is that because of the interest rate hike?
Yeah, is that the performance in those for the managers?
Yes.
That's a good observation. Most of those that underperformance in those sectors are not from banks. It is from some lending companies that are in the financial sector. PRA is one of them, and that stock was hit pretty hard during the quarter. Also, the being underweight REITs, which growth managers are typically not big investors in REITs, but having less exposure to that has led them. But most of it's probably interest rate driven, because a lending company will be affected by rising interest rates, but it's not having exposure to your banks that caused that within the small growth universe.
All right.
Any other questions? Thank you for your time.
I didn't hear any other questions?
That's it.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. We certainly appreciate having the privilege to work with you, and look forward to chatting with you next time.
Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So the value added report,
mm-hmm.
that goes along with that. I had a question in case anyone else was curious about it as well. I just wanted to kind of discuss it. The report from the company, looking at inception returns, say it's 16.58% net of fees, but then when you look at the value added report, it's clearly negative for the last couple of quarters, and my question was, well, why would that be? And Rick feels it is just the they perform so close to the benchmark that it really is just the custodial fees.
Well, remember though, the 16% return you quoted is an absolute. That's an absolute return, and this is a relative measurement. It's relative to the benchmark less fees. And so if you look at their relative performance, they're just barely above the benchmark after managerial fees, but then you subtract out the custodial fees and they drop down below the benchmark ever so slightly. Legato has been just riding the benchmark after fees for quite some time, and that's kind of why it struck me when I was looking at the report when Victor was talking, is that the risk is somewhat less than the benchmark, so the money that we're paying to manage this fund, we're essentially getting benchmark returns, and the money that we're paying seems to me that we're getting lower risk overall in the portfolio, or in that part of the portfolio.
It's that metric is time specific, so
right, sure.
Providing is since inception. We'll take a look in a little bit in the over different time periods, 3 and 5 years, that picture changes. So there's actually incremental higher risk over a shorter time period.
So, Rick, would it be accurate to say that if we're looking for areas to take out of equities and put somewhere else, this would be a place to start?
I think Ed would probably be better to answer that question.
You can consider it.
I mean, we've had them on watch for
a long time,
and they haven't.
We have.
Haven't done anything.
I mean, is it generally typical that small-cap growth active managers don't necessarily perform well above the benchmark? Do they hover, or are there managers literally out there that consistently do a good job above the benchmark? Because that's an area, that's an area of the capital markets I think you could exploit if you spent a lot of time doing your research, because it's small cap.
Right. We think so too as an intuition, but when we go and actually try to find managers that do, what we find is that they tend to be cyclical outperformers, underperformers. So at times you're riding the wave high and you're very happy with your choice. Other times they're below and you're pulling your hair out. And we haven't found a manager that consistently delivers excess performance over time. And so typically when we look at the asset allocation, we look at small cap core. We don't try to go growth and value in it, and we try to index it typically. And that just ends up being the best solution. So it maintains all of our sanity and ends up with the same net result at the end of the day too.
Just really quickly, why is it you think that you can't find consistent small cap growth managers out there? Again, it seems to me on the surface that this would be an area of the capital markets that could be exploited.
It's a good question. I mean, I don't know if there's any one right answer to it. Some managers who do a great job of buying hold on to them too long, and so they fall in love with the stocks that they have. They don't have a good sell discipline around it. There's some quantitative strategies that do well. DFA is probably an example of a strategy that is actively managed. It's not, it's index-based but different. Very low fees, over time tends to outperform, but it too will go through periods of underperformance. And I think it just proves that the market is the market, that you think you're so smart, you've done all your research and making the website. So I think that's the challenge.
It's just that if we're coming up on 2 years of negative cumulative value added at a five-year look back, I think at some point we have to really look at whether or not this is a market we want to be in.
So last year we were going to put together a manager continuation policy. We put that on hold because Verus was coming on board. And that's something that's on our plates very shortly here. We're going to actually go down to Ed's office in a few weeks, and we're going to talk about several things on the table. And I feel, and you may not feel this way, but I don't know if we've talked about this, but I feel that we should put together a formal continuation policy before we take any action on anybody right now, because we really don't have a formal continuation policy. And I know that I felt like we were flying by the seat of our pants when we terminated a manager. Actually, it was shortly after I got here. It felt like we were really flying by the seat of our pants. We struggled to put together statistics to give to the board to allow them to make a good decision, and I didn't feel that there was any structure in that decision, and I'd like to put together some structure before we take any formal action.
Well, that, and we have the asset allocation
right
pending too, and I think that is the thing that really moves the needle on a lot of these asset classes. So this is, a manager within the plan. We can talk about this manager or substitutes to it, but if we're talking about the big building blocks of doing asset allocation, I think those are the things we should get right.
Regardless of performance, right?
That's right.
Yep.
That's right.
Rick, is it correct thinking that when small caps are down a little bit, large caps are up, and the reverse?
I've never heard.
Any relationship between the two?
They have a pretty strong positive correlation. Yeah. They tend to behave similarly. So there will be times where you see the divergence where large caps are underperforming and small caps are outperforming. But by and large, they tend to move together.
They track.
They track. They don't track with perfect, a correlation of one. But they aren't divergent either.
But they're both kind of having rocky time right now.
They are. Small cap is having a rockier time. So yeah. It's more volatile.
Which was kind of a surprise, wasn't it?
Not so much. Historically, they've been more volatile. I think our capital market assumptions feed them with a higher volatility expectation. So that's embedded in the recipe.
So Verus, you're up next.
We can pick up on the Legata discussion a little bit too when we go through the performance review. But next we have Panagora. And I'd like to introduce Panagora because at our last meeting we were debating some different asset mixes, and the board appropriately pushed back and said, wait a minute, you're asking us to consider emerging markets, you're asking us to consider risk parity, private equity. Maybe we need a little more education on these topics before we get too far. And so we said, great, we'll do emerging markets at this meeting and risk parity, and then we'll table private equity for the next meeting so that we have a nice three-part series. So risk parity gets us started. Among the asset mixes that we considered, we had this parity range anywhere from 0, 5% up to 10%. So it could be as much as 10% depending on what asset mix we decide on at the end of the day. So without further ado, I'll ask Lisa and Brian to join me over at this side of the table. I think you have their books. I'll sneak off the side and let them run their show from here, if that sounds good.
No, please. Be comfortable.
Okay.
Disregard the fact that the seats are electrocuted. Just always keep your answers what we want.
I'll be on the lookout for anyone to trigger.
They'll be here.
Well, thank you for inviting us. We really appreciate the opportunity to meet you. I'm Lisa Mahoney. I'm a relationship manager at Panagora. I work very closely with your consultant, Veris Investments, as well as many of our clients that are invested in our risk parity strategy. And with me is Brian Belton. Brian is a director at our firm. He is also a member of Panagora's operating committee that sets the business direction for our company. Brian joined Panagora in 2005, and he has been working on the risk parity strategy that we manage since its inception in 2006. Just for a little background, Panagora is located in Boston. We are managing approximately $40 billion for institutional plans such as yours. We manage over $5 billion in our risk parity multi-asset strategies. And Brian has been, as I said, working on the strategy since its inception in 2006. The strategy at Panagora was created by Dr. Eddie Chin, our chief investment officer in our multi-asset group. Eddie's actually credited with coining the term risk parity in his seminal research paper in 2005. And I'd be happy to forward that along to you all if you need some help getting to sleep at night. It's a little deep, but. So risk parity is a strategic part of Panagora's business. We truly believe in its value in helping plans create consistent wealth creation. So we're very happy to talk to anybody about its value and the asset class in general. So I'll turn it over to Brian unless you have any Panagora questions.
Thanks, Lisa, and thank you, everyone, for your time this afternoon. So my objective is to first make this interactive, because you clearly don't want to be listening to me for the next half hour, 45 minutes straight. But I really, in terms of what I want to accomplish, I want to define what this thing is, risk parity. I think anything with the word risk in the title is probably not a good marketing choice. Probably people are like, what is this? But I want that clear at the end of our discussion to clear kind of what it is, why it makes sense in plans, and kind of talk about some of the differences between this approach compared to more traditional approaches. So let's jump right into the presentation. If you turn to page 3 of the presentation, let's first tackle what is it. So what it is it's a long-only multi-asset portfolio. And so multi-asset in the sense that we invest in a bunch of different asset classes in aggregate to generate sources of return for our clients. Specifically, we're invested in the global equity markets, we're invested in the fixed income markets, and we're invested in the inflation-protected markets that includes inflation-linked bonds as well as commodities. The second thing it is, in addition to a multi-asset portfolio, is it's diversified. So we have exposure to equities in the portfolio to provide upside participation during periods of strong growth. We have exposure to fixed income in the portfolio for downside protection in periods of weaker than expected growth. And we have exposure to inflation-protected assets to preserve real rates of return during periods of heightened inflation. The third thing is probably what I want to spend the majority of the afternoon discussing, is it's an alternative weighting scheme. And what I mean by that is that a traditional approach starts with, I have $100, and I'm just going to divvy up those dollars to these different asset classes. What we're trying to do is we're trying to look through the dollars. And the real goal is to make every single asset class in the portfolio, equities, fixed income, and inflation-protected assets, matter to the outcome in a similar fashion. And there's a real big difference between diversifying your dollars and diversifying how the asset classes matter. And that's really the cusp of what we're talking about with risk pairing. It's that we're weighting the asset classes in a different way than was previously or traditionally done. So that's what it is. The next thing I want to get into is why does it make sense? But before I do that, I need to touch on what the universal investment objective is for all of our clients. And I'll be presumptuous to say that I'm guessing it's your investment objectives as well. So we define those on page 5 of this presentation. Every investor that we've worked with, and we work with some of the largest, most sophisticated pools of capital across the world, sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East and in Asia, large public pension plans in the U.S. state plans, as well as many California county plans that we're lucky enough to have as our clients. And everyone has, regardless of how big you are or your level of sophistication, everyone has a dual investment. Number one, you want to grow your plan assets through investment returns, and you want to be able to generate a return high enough that matches your actuarial assumption. But the second part, and in my opinion, it's generally underappreciated and underserved, is you care about the path. You want to be able to grow that wealth stable, and you care about it for two reasons. Number one, the mathematics of compounding returns. So if you have the same average return, and you get there by 10% a year, every year, that investor's going to do much better. They're going to accumulate more wealth just because of the way math compounds than someone that's up 20, down 30, up 50. You have the same average return, but you accumulate more wealth because of the compounding. The second thing is that while you're long-term investors, you're not. You have to pay out benefits to your beneficiaries. And so you don't want to be paying out benefits after a 40% correction, because that makes it more difficult to compound. So the path of how you accumulate that wealth is critically important. And that really gets into diversification. And that's really where risk parity is adding its most value. Because it's more diversified than traditional approaches, it's going to compound more attractively. Okay. So let's talk about how this strategy meets both of those investment objectives. Let's talk about the returns first, because I think that's what everyone's most interested in. So where do we get the returns? So if you look at page 6 of the presentation, we're getting the returns primarily from what we call the primary colors of market premium. So we have long-only investment in the equity markets. We have long-only investments in the interest rate markets, and we have long-only investments in the inflation-protected assets. And the reason that there's a payoff to each one of these different markets or investments, premium, is that over time, for example, for equities, if you give your money to a corporation, so when you buy an equity, that's what you're doing. You're buying ownership into a stock. They're taking that capital, and through CapEx and through investment, they're levering it up against the global economy. As the global economy grows, they are going to be able to generate a rate of return that's going to give you a positive return over cash. Same thing with debt or interest rates. You're taking money, your alternative is cash. You're extending that and buying a bond, 5 years, 10-year maturity. And over long enough periods of time, you're going to do better. You're going to earn a premium for having that bond as opposed to if you continue to roll it over in cash. And then same thing with inflation-protected assets. Buying real assets allows you to preserve your rates of return, generate real returns, not nominal returns, regardless of inflation. So these are sort of investments that everyone here is familiar with, and there's an intuition about why there's a payoff. Now, there's all sorts of other different kinds of investments, things like private equity or high yield or credit. And we consider those blends of these different products premiums. So for example, if you invest in high yield, it's a bond, so there is an interest rate component to it, but that credit spread is more equity-like. Right? And that's why in this diagram, you mix blue and yellow together, you get green. But the primary drivers of return, the main factors, are these three. And for this portfolio, that's where we're looking to source the returns. Okay. The second part is the stability. Okay, and this is where traditional approaches sometimes struggle. What the chart on page 7 shows is a time series of what's called the Bloomberg U.S. Economic Surprise Index. And what this is doing is it's taking these different economic data releases, things like retail sales, non-farm payrolls, and they're comparing what people's expectations were to what they actually printed. So for example, if you thought, if the market thought that we were going to have positive job growth, 200,000 jobs, non-farm payroll jobs next year, and what actually wound up happening was 250,000 were created, that's a positive surprise. If 150,000 were created, it's a negative surprise. The reason that this is relevant is that all assets and investments are based on market expectations. When you buy a stock today, you're paying 15 to 20 times earnings. And the reason you're doing that is because there's an expectation that corporations are going to grow earnings at a fast enough rate. Now, you may grow them faster, slower, or right at that number. But the valuation you pay today is based on that expectation. And when there's surprises to these expectations, either positive or negative, that's what causes volatility or repricing of valuations. And if you look at the table on page 7, what we look at is we look at three different asset classes. We look at U.S. stocks, we look at U.S. government bonds, and we look at commodities. And we look at how they perform in these different environments. When there's in months where there's positive surprises, U.S. stocks average an annualized 22% return. But in months where there's negative surprises, they lose nearly 2% a year. For bonds, are the exact opposite. When there's positive surprises, they're basically flat over this 10 to 15 year period. They make 90 basis points a year, nothing to get excited about. But when there's negative surprises, they make 11% a year. This is the power of diversification. So what you want to do is you want to identify these asset classes that gain when others are losing. So that's part of it. But the other part, which is where risk parity comes in, is you want to make them matter as much. If you're in a negative surprise environment and you're losing money from U.S. stocks, you want to make sure you own enough bonds to create an offset.
Okay. So does this say we should never invest in commodities?
It was a bad idea in the last 10 to 15 years. But it's an important asset class to invest in because at the end of the day, your beneficiaries you need to pay them real returns. Like they're going to be consuming food, and they're going to be using their benefits to buy food and to buy gas at the pump. And the fact of the matter is that while commodities have come down, gas prices have cheapened, making those purchases cheaper. But if we are in a 1970s environment, right, where the cost of food went up, where the cost of the cost of energy went up, where the cost of cotton for clothes went up, you would want the beneficiaries to get a higher rate of return to compensate for that. So that's why having some level of inflation protection in the portfolio makes some sense. Now, one of the things that we believe is that maybe not as much as equities and bonds, but you should get some.
It looks like a sure loser the way you've got it out here.
So the last 10 or 15 years it has been. I mean, just think about the last 2 years. Oil was at 110. In 2014, it went to 40. Now it's 27. So the price of oil, which is a big driver of commodity indices, has collapsed. Right.
Well, it's not just oil. It's aluminum. It's copper. The agricultural commodities. It's everything.
That's right. But the offset of that is the consumption price of those things have gone down. So we're not a big believer that you should have a large allocation to inflation-protected assets, but we think it's consistent with plans' investment objectives of having to pay beneficiaries real rates of return as opposed to nominal returns, and inflation-protected assets are one way to help protect that. So we've sort of made a case of, you should have equities in and bonds in, maybe not a compelling case about commodities, although should.
Just what percentage of commodities do you think is appropriate in your strategy?
So we typically have anywhere between 10 to 15% of the capital invested in the commodities market.
What about the breakdown between fixed income and and equities.
So we'll get to that. Let me address it immediately, though. We think about the exposure in this portfolio two ways. We think about it in terms of what we call risk contribution, how much it matters to the outcome of the portfolio. So the breakdown between those three asset classes, we want 40% of the return to come from the equity markets, we want 40% of the return to come from the fixed income markets, and 20% of the return to come from the inflation-protected markets, half commodities, half inflation-linked bonds. That's from a risk contribution perspective. Now, what that means in dollars invested is different, and that's actually a good segue to the next part of the discussion. Because everything up to this point is probably not earth-shattering, right? Most plans have some equities, they have some bonds, and they have probably some real assets in it. But what's probably kind of that earth-shattering, but what's really impactful about risk parity is we're weighting it in a way that's different than a traditional approach, which is we don't want the dollars to be diversified. We want to have an impact, the outcome, the return diversified. So let's jump to page 9 of the presentation. Let's talk about this diversification piece, this weighting piece. How do we make these assets matter similarly? So page 9 highlights the bullet points of what's the key to stable wealth creation. So you want consistent upside participation for periods of strong growth. You want downside protection for periods of weaker growth. And you want to have consistency across these different macroeconomic environments. You don't know what's going to happen next, right? You don't know what the next surprise is going to be. The beginning of this year, the surprise has been negative. People were very surprised in a bad way about how weak things got so quickly. But the next 2 or 3 months may be a surprise on the upside. Maybe it's not so bad. And if you have a portfolio that's balanced across these different market environments, you can achieve your goals more consistently. So page 10 is a summary of a traditional approach to a multi-asset class portfolio. So on the left-hand side is how the capital is invested. So you start with $100. You could put $35 in domestic equities, $20 in international equities, 35% in core fixed income, and then maybe 10% in real assets, infrastructure and real estate. Right? So on the left-hand side, that looks pretty balanced. It looks pretty diversified. But if you look at the right-hand side of the page, this is the risk allocation. Right? And what this is saying is that this plan that's balanced their dollars between stocks and bonds and real assets, 85% of the risk contribution is coming from the equity markets, and only 2% is coming from the fixed income markets. And again, you can think about risk contribution as how much are these asset classes contributing to the outcome of the portfolio, which is why if you look at the line chart at the bottom of page 10, what this maps is the U.S. equity market from 2006 on compared to this public plan, this proxy, that has 55% of their equities, 35% in fixed income, and then 10% in real assets. It almost tracks lockstep. This portfolio that diversifies their capital, their outcome of their portfolio is tracking the equity market. And that's why if you look across most institutions, most plans, they were, 2008 was a nightmare. The periods like 2013 that had a very U.S. Equity-centric route was a great year. And to meet the objectives, while you may be able to get to the 7% return following the equity market, you're going to do there with a lot of instability. The risk parity tries to improve on that. So how does it do it? Well, actually, before I do that, let me explain why that's the case. Let me explain why there's a difference between capital balancing and risk balancing. And the answer is summarized on page 11. The reason that if you take $50 and put it in the equity market, $50 in the bond market, your portfolio looks like an equity portfolio, is because the magnitude of equity returns, both positive and negative, are 3 to 4 times larger than the magnitude of bond returns. Right? So what that means is that equity returns matter more. Think about it. A really good year for equities, you're up 20%. A really bad year, you're down 20%. But with bonds, a really good year for bonds, right, knock it out of the park, up 5%. A really bad year for bonds, down 5%. So those magnitude of returns, when you put equities in a really good year, or equities in a really bad year, bonds in a really good year, and you give them the same weight, your portfolio is going to be dominated by equities. If you look at the bar chart on the bottom of page 11, what I've done here is I've gone from 1973 to 2015, and I just took U.S. Treasuries and U.S. stocks, and I broke them, I looked at their monthly returns, and I broke them into 10 buckets, okay? Bucket 1 through 10 for stocks are the worst and best performing average returns during those 10 buckets. And then bonds are the exact opposite. So if you look at the top bar, decile 1, that's an environment where on a monthly basis, the worst 10% of months for U.S. stocks over the last 40 years are averaging 8% loss. And the best period for bonds are only 2.5%, 3% gain. Where on the bottom, decile 10, those are periods where stocks made 8% a month and bonds only lost 2%. So positive bond returns aren't big enough to matter when stocks are doing poorly. And negative returns in bonds aren't enough to matter when stocks are doing great. Okay, and that is the problem with capital weighting. Right? So what's the risk parity solution? The risk parity solution is to say, don't weight by capital, weight by risk contribution. And another way to think about that is own enough bonds in the portfolio such that they matter similarly, they're on similar footing to what equities are doing, okay? So on the left-hand side, this is how the dollars are invested, okay? So you're looking at 92% of your dollars are in international sovereign bonds, 62% are in U.S. treasuries, 12% are in credit. And in equities, you have 10% in small cap, 25% in global equities, and 8%. So if you sum up those weights, there's way more capital exposure or market exposure to the fixed income market than the equity market. But the reason you do that is for the pie chart on the right-hand side. And the pie chart on the right-hand side is saying this isn't risk contribution. This means that 40% of your returns are going to come from the equity market, 40% of your returns are going to come from the bond market, and 20% of the returns are going to come from the inflation-protected market. So risk parity is saying, how much market exposure do I need to own of bonds, stocks, and inflation-protected assets to make them all matter similarly to the final outcome of the portfolio? So when I do my attribution over long periods of time, what's driving the returns is balanced across these. And the reason you want to balance is going back to that diversification. So why is all of this matter? If you look at page 13 of the presentation, this is the aha moment. What we've done is we've taken a 60-40 portfolio, 60% in MSCI World, so global equities, 40% in global ag, so global fixed income. And we've compared this to a hypothetical risk parity portfolio. Right? And that hypothetical portfolio is something like 40% in U.S. stocks, 160% in U.S. treasuries, and 15% in commodities. In the top table, what you notice is that for the last 10 years, this hypothetical portfolio has outperformed the 60-40 portfolio by 260 basis points. That's good at the same risk, so it's been more efficient. But what's really important is the bottom table. We're reintroducing the surprise index again, right? But what we've done is we've taken these 10 years of returns, broken them into months, and we've aggregated the returns into months where there's positive surprises, months where there's negative surprises. The top panel of that bottom table shows, out of the 10 years, 55 months there were positive surprises, 65 months there were negative surprises. So the first important point is that surprises are normally distributed. Right? That makes sense. You're going to be positively surprised half the time and disappointed half the time. But in the periods where there's positive surprises, the 60-40 portfolio kills it. You're up 11% a year on 6% risk. So if you could just lock that in, go do that. And it beats the risk parity portfolio. Risk parity portfolio is only up 7.8%. It's less than 8%. So in periods where there's positive surprises, you're going to have people saying, why did you do this risk parity? You're getting killed by 60-40. And the answer is, because of the months of negative surprises. When there's negative surprises, this 60-40 portfolio makes less than 1% a year. But the risk parity portfolio makes the same amount, 7.9%. And unless you know whether you're going to be positively surprised over the next month or negatively surprised over the next month, then the consistency across those different environments of risk parity is really what becomes impactful to your return. So one of the things, in a way, I kind of going back to this weighting methodology, some of the ways I explain it to people that are just getting comfortable with it is I call it the bartender's approach to asset allocation. And what I mean by that is that if imagine an Irish guy walks into a bar, and I can say that because I'm Irish, so I don't make fun of myself, walks into a bar, and someone says, I'll have a beer, and someone says, I'll have whiskey. Is the bartender going to pull out two pint glasses and fill the whiskey in a pint glass and the beer in a pint glass? Absolutely not. What they're going to do is they're going to take the whiskey and put it in an 1.5-ounce glass, and they're going to put the beer in a 16-ounce glass. They've poured two dramatically different sized drinks, but they've done it in consideration of the alcohol by volume. They're trying to make its potency equivalent. And what risk parity managers are trying to do is the same thing with building a multi-asset portfolio. So in this case, in this analogy, stocks are the whiskey, and bonds is the beer. So you got to own, you got to pour your bond in a pint glass and your whiskey in an 1.5-ounce glass to make both those matter. And so from the optics of it, when you're looking at it, it looks like a bond-heavy portfolio. But at the end of the day, bonds don't matter any more than stocks do. You just have to own more of them. So that is really the essence of what it is. It's a multi-asset portfolio. It's more diversified than any other construct we can think of. But the key thing about it is that the way it gets that diversification is it's an alternative weighting scheme. Okay? And the reason we're doing that is reflexive of your plan objective. You want to generate returns that you care about to pay. So that, I hope, is the essence of what we're talking about. Now, unless there's any questions there, the other thing that I think is really important is that before any of our clients invest in a risk parity, you really kind of want to understand what's really different about this and how do you get comfortable with it. So if you look at page 15 of the presentation, we outline two of the big 800-pound gorillas in the box or in the room, which is this portfolio has leverage. Right? If that wasn't clear on the pie chart on page 12, the sum of these weights exceed 100%. So this portfolio has leverage. That's probably unique for traditional long-only multi-asset portfolio. So I want to talk about why, re-emphasize why it has leverage, and then re-emphasize why that's not scary. The second piece that's different about this portfolio is it probably has, from an optics perspective, more fixed income market exposure than a traditional multi-asset portfolio. So we want to re-emphasize why that's important. And then I also want to address investing in fixed income in a low interest rate environment. And what does that mean? Is that crazy? And then I just want to make a couple of very quick bullet points on manager selection. So the first thing is leverage. So why are we doing it? And page 16, we kind of have lay out three choices. The first thing you could do to meet your investment goals is you could just capitally balance. So 60% equities, 40% bonds. And you're probably going to get, if over a long enough period, you're going to get your actuarial assumption. You'll probably get 7 to 7.5% return with that portfolio. But you're just going to be a roller coaster ride. And you're going to have compounding returns working against you, and you're going to have to pay, you're going to have paying inter-period benefits out working against you. Okay. The second thing you can do is you can say, all right, well, if bonds or stocks are four times more risky than bonds, if I own 20% stocks and 80% bonds, that should be risk balanced. And what the objective you achieve there is you actually do get this stability. So in equities, get crushed, you have 20% exposure to it, and 80% exposure to bonds as a positive offset to get you there. The problem with that portfolio is it's not taking enough risk to be able to achieve your 7.5% return objective. That portfolio will probably get you 5%, 3 to 5% plus cash. So that's not enough. So now that leaves risk parity multi-asset, which is the 20-80 portfolio for the diversification. But it introduces leverage to get you up to the same expected return of an equity-heavy portfolio, but gets you there in a more diversified way. that's why you're doing it. Now, is that, what are the risks of that? Is that scary? So anyone that tells you that leverage doesn't have risk is misleading. There's risk in everything you do, risk and leverage. But it's probably not as scary as you think, and it can be managed. Let's make a couple of points on that. Number one is that the modern economy is built on leverage. If you buy equities, publicly traded equities, they're levered. If a corporation has debt on their balance sheet, that's a levered investment. Private equity, levered. Anyone here own a home with a mortgage? Levered. Anyone ever own a mortgage-backed security? Levered. So leverage is just is inherent in the economy and its inherent investments. But the key distinction, why people aren't worried about leveraging equities and why people aren't worried about leveraging REITs or other things, is that there's securitization. So if you buy an equity, right? So Apple has debt on the books. You buy Apple. That's a levered investment. But if Apple goes bankrupt, nobody's going to come calling you and say, hey, you own 10 shares of Apple. Can you pay us the negative asset value, negative book value of the company? No, it's securitized. You own units of it. The shares have a zero floor. It can't go below zero. All of our clients that invest, and not just our funds, but all the other providers that have a commingled vehicle, it's non-recourse leverage or borrow. Right? So you own units of that vehicle, whether it's ours or another providers of it, and they can't go less than zero. So from that perspective, the leveraging of commingled vehicle is no different than the leverage in equities. Okay? So that's one point, is that there's a lot of leverage everywhere. The second thing is probably more important, is how do you manage it? Nobody wants it to go to zero. So how do you manage the risks of leverage? So the first thing is, what we're talking about levering here are very liquid investments. We're talking things like sovereign government bonds, U.S. treasuries, U.K. treasuries. The equities that are in it are developed market, publicly traded equities. We do have a very small exposure to emerging market equities, probably about 5-7% of the capital in the portfolio. But even that segment of the portfolio is very liquid. So where leverage goes bad is levering something that's illiquid, like the subprime mortgage. They were the underlying collateral was home prices, and you couldn't sell a home, so you're stuck. Right? But we can manage and bring down the leverage of the portfolio by trading it very easily. The second piece is we have large amounts of unencumbered cash. So about 35-50% of this portfolio is sitting in cash, which allows us to be able to manage the leverage and rebalance the portfolio fairly seamlessly. And then the last piece is how do you achieve leverage? So not all leverage is built equally. And so the way we're getting it is through exchange-traded futures. So what that means is that's instrument leverage. It's not borrowed leverage. So for example, if I want to buy a U.S. Treasury government future, right, what happens is that future, the price and the return of that is based on a $100,000 investment in a treasury bond. But I only need to put up $2,000 of collateral. Okay, that's different than if I were to go out and borrow $100,000 and then buy that treasury. You have the same amount of leverage, but the borrowing lines, the liquidity of that, the rebalancing of it, the term risk of that, is much less liquid. So we have a very, we're levering something that's very liquid. We have a lot of cash to be able to support it, and the way we're achieving it is a very transparent, instrument-based way to leverage. And it's not just us; it's every provider that I'm aware of, and I can speak to it more. More thoughtfully than I can, but I believe everyone is achieving it this way. So if you're going to have leverage in the portfolio, it's a fairly safe way to have it.
Does the cash equal the value of, or the risk of the leverage, the cash that you have on hand?
Yeah. So we have, on average, we have about $200 of market exposure for every $100 of capital we have. So the leverage is about 2-1, okay? Out of that $100 that we have, $35 to $50 is sitting in cash to be able to manage the collateral and any sort of margin calls that we may have from from that exposure, that amount of leverage.
So you have like 50%. If there were a meltdown, you had 50%.
Yeah, it ranges between 30 to 50. And to put that into context, when we put on this leverage with which is exchange traded futures, and that's actually regulated by the CFTC, which is the government agency about how much collateral we have to post. Our portfolio is requires to have about 3.5% posted collateral. And we have 10 to 15 times that on average. So we have much more than what the government requires us to hold for collateral. And so we've been managing this portfolio for a long time. We managed it through the credit bubble in 2006, global financial crisis in 2008, three European sovereign debt crises, all sorts of geopolitical risk, Ukraine incursions, North Korea, and have never once had a problem where we were tight on cash or got margin call that we weren't able to meet 10 times over. We've been doing it for 10 years. There's other guys that have been doing it for 10 years as well. To the best of my knowledge, no one's ever run into an issue. So there's leverage in the portfolio. It's important to point that out. You have to know it. You have to get comfortable with it. But the non-recourse nature of it, as well as the risk management that's been built around it and the history of being able to employ that risk management successfully, provides many of our clients comfort that this is a manageable risk. And you really come up with a decision around, do you want to manage leverage risk? Are you more comfortable with that? Or do you want to get your returns through concentration risk by going all in on the equity market? That's really the trade-off. And in our opinion, a lot of the clients that have decided to partner with us, as well as our competitors, have chosen to take on this leverage risk to reduce the concentration risk. That's the trade.
So who's deciding what your cash level is, or how much cash you're going to keep on hand to manage this potential meltdown or whatever?
Right. So the exchange, so the CFTC is the government regulator on future exchanges, is determining what's required.
Right.
Okay. As part of our investment process, for the 10 years we've been managing it, our range of cash has been between 35 to 50%, and that's just a function of where our portfolio is tilted at any particular time. If we have a favorable view on cash related assets, like buying physical equities or physical bonds, we're going to use up more cash. If we're more tilted towards asset classes we achieve through futures, like things like commodities or sovereign bonds, we're going to have more cash.
But it's your call. And the government requirement you said earlier was 2 or 3%.
Yeah. So for our portfolio, it averaged 3.5%. That's correct.
Do you think anybody that has this kind of a portfolio with 3% could exist very long, could manage a portfolio effectively if that was there?
So if you manage it to the bare minimum of 3.5% cash, operationally it would be very complex. It's not impossible, but I wouldn't want to have to do that. And the reason is that you have 3.5%, the portfolio loses value, the exchange calls, margin call. You need to go back up to the top and then replace what you lost. Then you got to sell assets and move it around. So I'm not aware of anyone that's manages that razor thing.
But you're at 50%? Is that
so? Yeah, so the historic range is 35 to 50%.
Cash.
But you're only required to have 2 or 3%.
Correct.
So maybe another way of approaching this would be, do you have a risk monitoring system that helps you indicate when that number is getting on the low side, or when you think it's on the high side, you can redeploy it somewhere?
Yeah, so I think we look at risk in a couple of ways. One is, obviously we're managing cash balances every day. We're looking at the portfolio. We're wiring out, either receiving money in or wiring money out to true up the day's P&L. So one thing about futures is they're what they're called daily mark-to-market. So you make money on a day, you take that money back to the exchange. You lose money, you send it back to the exchange. So we're always monitoring that relative to what our available cash is. The other thing is we have fairly robust risk monitoring systems. So we're looking, measuring leverage on a daily basis. We're measuring where the total risk of the portfolio is as well as where it's coming from to make sure that the total risk of the portfolio is around 10% risk, which is very similar to what a 60-40 portfolio is, and that risk is decomposed across in a balanced way across stock, bond, and inflation-protected assets.
Can you describe what a nightmare scenario would be for this portfolio, in your from your firm's point of view?
Yeah. So, I guess there's two ways to look at it. On an absolute return basis, like, you know, think about absolute return. Can we generate 7.5% a year for, you know, extended periods of time? The nightmare scenario is we basically have a three-cylinder engine. We think about equities, we think about fixed income, and we think about inflation-protected assets. And the nightmare situation is all three of those things do poorly at the same time. Now, traditionally, if you think about this diversification benefit, and we, you know, showed how these things react differently to negative surprises, if interest rates are rising, and you're, you know, rising more aggressively than what was priced into the market, you're going to lose money on fixed income. But they typically rise for one of two reasons. They rise because growth is really good, and that's an environment that equity should do well. But they rise because inflation is becoming untethered. That's an environment where inflation protected assets are. There have been periods, and many of them, are, by the way, are around central bank issues. So 2004, when the Fed started to hike rates, that was bad for the equity market because people thought, okay, they're taking the punch bowl away from equities. It was bad for the fixed income market because the Fed signaled we're going to hike interest rates more aggressively than what people thought. And it's bad for inflation-protected assets because if you're taking away stimulus, you're tightening, that's deflationary. That happened in 2004, it happened in 2013 as well. But those periods tend to be short-lived. So in 2013, May and June, this portfolio lost 9% cumulative, which is the largest drawdown we've had since we've been running it in 10 years. But the following 12 months, it made more than four to five-fold. So what happens is you get this repricing of equities, repricing of fixed income, and then all of a sudden the value anchor kicks in and it starts to do really well again. So that's it on an absolute basis. The bigger risk, I think, is more on a peer relative basis. So most people think is, you know, okay, multi-asset portfolios, they're benched against 60-40. Right? But as we know, and we showed, these are equity-heavy portfolios. So when the equity market does really well, this risk parity portfolio ought to do well, but it's going to lag. And sometimes we'll get from clients that have made, you know, meaningful moves into this portfolio. In 2013, we were up 3.5-4%. The U.S. equity market was up 30%. So most people that were heavily concentrated in the U.S. equity portfolio were up 13-14% in 2013. We were up 4% and said, oh, this thing's busted. But what happened in 2013 is that fixed income didn't do particularly well. Inflation-protected assets did very poorly. And globally, equities, the run was really focused on U.S. equities. Global equities didn't do that great. So in periods of when concentration works in your favor, you're going to be disappointed on a peer relative basis. But we're not. You guys are more worried about that than we are. We're more worried about the absolute basis, which is everything stops working at the same time.
When you said some of the peers have made meaningful investments, what's the definition of a meaningful investment on a relative basis?
So we have a client, a U.S. public pension plan that has right now they have about 15% of their plan in it, and they're looking to increase it.
Is that considered a lot?
That's above average.
Okay.
I would say the life cycle of these things are most people put their toes in with. Something at 5-7.5%, and then, you know, once they see how it behaves, they start to get more comfortable with it. We'll see clients come back and expand their exposure.
What are some of the typical questions that you might get when you go back out to a group of people like this, trustees like this, after the strategy has been in place for a couple of years? What do you tend to hear from the trustees?
So I think it's very focused on you know, sort of what the current events or what the trailing, you know, 3 months or 6 months of performance is, right? So, you know, right now, so in January, we were up, you know, close to 2%. And, you know, most people that were equity heavy when equity markets were down 7, 10%, you know, are down a fair amount. So they say, wow, this thing's great. But then at the same token, in 2013, we're up 3.5%, U.S. equities are down 30%. So it's really hard to get away from, you know, benchmarking against a traditional approach. So that's, you know, explaining, sort of reminding people about the goal of this portfolio is to get to this return, and the best way to do it consistently is to make these different asset classes that are diversifying to one another matter similarly. And in any environment where one particular asset class shined and you were concentrated to that, you're going to do well. But over long periods of time, unless you have a crystal ball that can tell you which one's going to shine. So, you know, sort of reinforcing the drivers of it and when it's going to underperform and when it's going to outperform relative to what their proxy is.
Do you feel that most groups keep that in mind, what you just said, or do they tend to get buyer's remorse when their peers are outperforming?
It takes constant reminders.
Yeah, I would think so.
But, you know, I think the clients that we've gained are ones that can resist the temptation to look at short-term performance and understand the strategic importance of a portfolio, which is when everything's going south, this thing is a built-in stabilizer, should be a built-in stabilizer for the plan. And if the U.S. equity markets are up 30% and I'm only up 7, I'm okay with that. Now, that's hard. People can say it now, but when they're living through it, it's hard for people to say that. But, you know, continually reminding them what its point is. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is the two things that I was kind of focusing on, what's different, which is leverage. So people need to get comfortable with leverage, reminded about, you know, why you do it, and how do you manage it and why it's okay and safe. And then the second one, which we haven't got to yet, but time permitting, I'd like to touch on quickly, is okay, you're telling me this portfolio is 150% exposure to fixed income and rates are 2%? You're crazy. And explaining to them, number one, why its strategic importance is there to diversify. Number two, which is more important, is that, and it comes as a surprise to a lot of people, you can make money in bonds in a rising interest rate environment. And so, you know, I spend a lot of time making sure that's clear to people. Because if we were suggesting you own bonds, and the only reason you own bonds is for Armageddon, you're going to lose money on bonds except for in 2008, that would be a bad investment strategy. What you want is you want to own bonds that are going to make money even when equities are making money, but they're really going to pay off when equities are losing their share. Right? So if time permitting and we're good with sort of the leverage, I just want to make a couple of points on kind of this fixed income, why it's okay to have such big capital exposure. So the first one on page 18, I think we've covered, it's diversified. So we look at the correlation between U.S. stocks and U.S. bonds, and on average it's close to zero. In fact, it's a little positive. But when you break down the events, the 20% of the worst periods for equities, that's where bonds become the most diversified. Where that's a unique characteristic of high-grade treasuries. You know, high yield or some other things may not look to be uncorrelated with equities, but when things get worse, that's when they really move, go in the opposite direction. And then 18 is, I showed you this earlier, is the difference in performance across these different surprises. The other piece, at the page 20, is that you have to understand that fixed income, all assets are based on what people's expectations are. People's expectations are for interest rates to rise. Of course interest rates are going to rise. But you can make money in fixed income even if interest rates rise. The question that you really have to ask yourself, are they going to rise more aggressively over a shorter horizon than what's currently priced in the yield curve? So you know that market thinks interest rates are going to rise because 10-year yields are higher than cash. So people think that, you know, you could roll cash every day for 10 years or you can invest in a 10-year treasury, and you're going to be, that means that in order for that to happen, cash needs to continue to rise in the next 10 years. So in this example, we just have a very theoretical example. Imagine 1-year yields are 1 and 2-year yields are 3, right? So from an equivalency perspective, you can invest in a 2-year bond, get 3% in year 1, 3% in year 2, you've accumulated 6%. Or you can invest in a 1-year bond and then invest in another 1-year bond a year from now. In order for that to be equivalent, the 1-year bond a year from now needs to be 5%. So in this environment, they're saying, if you invest in bonds, the market expectation is interest rate rise 5% over the next year. Okay? So I call this the, you know, investing in bonds is kind of like the office football pickup. So if you look at page 21 of the presentation, what we've done is we've looked at the five largest NFL spreads in the history of the NFL. And every one of those teams covered, which means they won the game. I'm sorry. Every single one of those teams won the game, so the favorite won, but only one of them covered. So you can think about that point spread as the market expectations from in fixed income of how much interest rates are going to rise. And in the bottom table, the last time rates rose was in 2004. So at the time of the increase in rates starting, the market expected that interest rates over the next year were going to rise 100 basis points. They only rose 75. So what that means is that investing in fixed income, even though rates rose 75 basis points, you made more money than current yield. So you lost the game, but you covered the spread. And so investing in fixed income is not just insurance for a bad equity market period. It's actually you're getting return from investing in fixed income as long as the market expectations are reasonable today. But it's really, so you're getting that return, positive carry, but you're also getting an insurance policy. So I think that's important, getting people comfortable with leveraging fixed income. The last thing I just want to touch on is if you consider that risk parity makes sense for the plan. One thing that I think surprises a lot of people is the dispersion in manager performance. So I think people say, okay, risk parity, and we're all the same, but there's differences in how people do it, and so there's differences in how long people have been doing it. So I think you want to consider the length of track record, the strength of the track record, and the process. I'm sure your consultant, if you pursue this, will talk to you about this.
Can you talk a little bit about the weightings that you have today and how dynamic they are and what drives those decisions?
Right. So everything I sort of talked to you today is not specific to our process. It's a very general, generic philosophy about risk parity in general. And I would guess that most providers would agree with a lot of the statements. There are some differences about how people do it. One is from a strategic risk allocation. Some people think that bonds, equities, and commodities should matter the same. It's our process that we should have a lower exposure to commodities. And the reason that is we think it's more of a risk that ought to be hedged than an asset class that has a real attractive premium. So that's one difference. Another difference is we have a tactical aspect. So our strategic allocation is this 40-40-20, 40 to equities, 40 to fixed income, 20 to commodities. But that's just a strategic allocation. We have a tactical component that allows us to make tactical changes around that strategic target to make the portfolio adaptive to changing market conditions. Today, we are moderately underweight equities and inflation-protected assets and overweight fixed income relative to our strategic targets. The drivers of that are two things. One is technical in nature. So we think that most asset classes cross-sectionally exhibit some level of momentum. So this has been a fairly favorable momentum environment for fixed income and a poor one for equities and commodities. So that's justifying that. We also have a valuation anchor. So all things equal, we want overweight assets that are more attractive at the expense of assets that are rich. The technical signals in favor of fixed income relative to equities and commodities. The valuation anchor now, with fixed income having such a rally, has actually become underweight to fixed income. But in balance, we have very small active risk around overweight to fixed income by a couple of percent, and underweight to equities and commodities each by a percent each.
So you have active rebalancing in this. How does that the fees compare to like a traditional, you know, setup?
So yeah, I'll start on sort of the active rebalancing. There's two on the active rebalancing. There's two pieces of it. So this portfolio is targeting a constant level of market risk. So as assets become riskier and correlations go up, we're actually de-levering the portfolio. So it has constant exposure. It's not drifting like a traditional portfolio. So that's part of the active rebalance as we re-estimate risk and correlation. The other part of the active rebalance is what I alluded to previously, which is the overweight to fixed income at the expense of equity and commodities. So that's part of it. In terms of fees, I can tell you that our management fee for our product is 35 basis points. Ed is probably in a better position to talk about how that looks relative to other managers and approaches.
And that's just an ad valorem, a AUM? That's the only fee associated with this strategy?
Yeah, that's right. So it's a managed. We don't have a performance fee on it because we think it's more of kind of a beta. I think we do have it's a standard fee schedule, so all the participants in the fund get exposure to the same fee schedule. I think there are reductions in the fee based on asset breaks. I don't exactly know what those levels are off the top of my head.
Okay.
And also in the commingled vehicles, there would be fund-related administrative expenses, but that would be with any commingled vehicle that you use.
Approximately, what are those?
We have two different kinds. One is a U.S.-based group trust that's for ERISA-qualified assets only. That's, I want to say, 6 to 8 basis points.
Okay.
We also have an offshore. Actually, it's about the same. I'm just going to say 8 to 9 basis
okay.
points. Given that the size of each has been
they're
a billion or over a billion each.
And that's, you know, custody, legal, admin,
that's everything.
Yeah.
And an unusual investment like this, there wouldn't be any benchmarks that we could measure this, I wouldn't think.
So, yeah, the benchmarking one is always tricky. We've written some papers on it, and we basically have a couple of permutations. First is 60-40. And the reason you use 60-40 is that's generally a universal benchmark for asset allocation portfolios. Why that's appropriate is it's the same level of market risk, around 10% fall. Why it's inappropriate is there's this huge asset allocation difference. So when equities do well, 60-40 is going to look better. When equities do poorly, risk parity is going to look better. So that's one. And another one that we use is a custom risk parity benchmark. So what it's doing is it's taking MSCI World for equities, World Government Bond Index for sovereign bonds, and then GSCI Index for commodity, and coming up with a fixed weight in a levered fashion. So let's call it 140% to World Government Bond Index, let's call it 40% to MSCI World, and let's call it 20% to GSCI. And you just do that three blend. The benefit of that is it's actually going to track risk parity performance reasonably well. The bad thing is it's fairly complex to understand and then relate. Our favorite benchmark is actually our performance relative to the peer universe. So that's the other way.
I think from our perspective, the 60-40 would be a good benchmark because it's a choice whether to stay or go. And if you stay, you're probably going to go with the more traditional asset allocation. If you go, you're going to go to this. So that, to me, seems like a sensible benchmark. And it is investable, too.
Right. That's the most commonly chosen one.
Yeah.
And as long as it's a value over a long enough horizon,
mm-hmm.
We think over a period of time it's going to have a similar level of risk. It's going to have better return and better sharp if you capture over a cycle 3 to 5 years.
So I have a question a little bit back to the fees, and I know you don't totally control this, but pretty much with the custodian banks, every movement costs money, in, out, sideways, whatever. Everything you do, there's another fee to it.
Yeah.
My concern would be with this, but appears to be so much movement, is this going to, our custodial fees, might go up.
Yeah,
considerably.
So, right. So things like, we kind of view those as transaction costs.
Right.
Things like ticket
right.
costs and you trade
right.
international stock. and there's a ticket cost on the bottom.
Exactly.
So those aren't explicit fees that are accrued or come out as an expense. They're just a function of the performance.
Right.
So, you know, if we're gonna trade the portfolio such that the trades we make are accretive net of transaction costs. So we measure the transaction costs of the portfolio on an aggregate basis, all, considering all the turnover. We estimate that to be somewhere between 50 to 60 basis points annualized. That's custodian ticket costs, it's bid offer, it's market impact from trading all the futures and all the equities. And that is inherent in our performance. So when you look at performance streams, you know, if we had no transaction costs, our performance would probably be 50 basis points annualized.
Okay.
But the fact of the matter is that unless you don't rebalance a portfolio, everyone has transaction costs.
But you keep custody of the assets here, not the custodian bank, right?
So where do the assets sit? At our custodian bank or your custodian?
Nope. So if you're in the commingled vehicle, the fund has a custodian.
Right.
Right.
So the assets
sit there, not
and
in
then
ours.
For the small percentage that's required by the CFTC for the futures trading, that money is parked as collateral at the futures broker, but it's segregated where the fund is the beneficial owner.
Okay. Thank you.
Are your equities generally large cap?
So we have global equities, which are developed market large cap, so that the universe there is the MSCI world. We have small cap U.S. and emerging market equities. Majority of the equity risk is coming from the large cap global equities.
What percentage of small cap if we don't worry?
So small cap is about 10% of the entire portfolio. In both risk as well as capital. Emerging market equities is about 10% of the risk. It's about 7% of the capital by average. I'm happy to answer any other questions. Just to conclude, page 24, just three quick bullets. Risk parity is really designed to meet the dual investment objective of all plans. So it's going to try to get the returns by investing in the market premium, and it's going to manage a stable path by creating this diversification to alternative weighting scheme. Number two is that risk parity can help a plan because it does well on a relative basis when the plan most needs it. So in January of 2016, in September of October of 2008, it's going to do much better in those environments because it does have more downside protection than the traditional approaches. The last point is that the big difference is around leverage and around owning fixed income. Leverage can be managed, the risk involved with that. And then owning fixed income is probably not as bad, even in low interest rate environments, as people think it is, because it's all based on what interest rates do relative to what the market expectations are. And right now, the market's expecting interest rates to rise 50 to 70 basis points over the next 12 months. So if you think interest rates are going to increase over the next 12 months 150 basis points, you'll probably have lost contribution for fixed income. But you hope if it's going to rise that much because growth is much better than what people thought and you're going to have really good returns from equities, or it's because inflation is problematic and you're going to have help from commodities and inflation problems.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to take a quick break here while we reset up for the next one. Ferris. So, flash report?
Flash report is probably in front of you, the one or two pages. For January, we also have the quarterly performance report. So you're going to see January was down quite a bit.
Okay.
I don't have any commentary on January performance from the managers just yet, but I will dive into that in a moment on the quarter results. And for the month of January, there was no safe place. The fixed income markets were modestly positive. The equity markets were a complete disaster, down between 5 and 11% domestically. Internationally, between 5 and 8%. High yield was also down. Emerging market debt was down. Real estate was close to monthly number. Commodities were down again. So a difficult month, but I'm sure you're not surprised by any of that. So before we dive into the materials, I wanted to just talk a little bit about that risk parity presentation. I hope that was helpful for you. I thought that was a little long, generally speaking, but a complex strategy as well. So glad you asked questions, and hopefully you got the questions that you wanted to have answered. We can talk more about how we proceed with that
donation to you.
The risk, or with the asset allocation. That being said, was there anything that anyone heard that would take risk parity off the table that we shouldn't be considering it? If there's any sort of deal killer, I guess, embedded in what you heard today?
It's an unusual investment. I didn't especially like the leverage at all. And I'm not really hot on commodities either. Even their own figures showed it's a losing deal to invest in commodities. I don't know why they stick.
As long as it comes in within expectations, it's fine. But if there are any surprises, up or down, it's going to take a hit, was what I saw in that.
Yeah, so it's if it's even.
Yeah. No, not necessarily even, but within expectations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Commodities just look like a loose deal.
They do, and you're not wrong, because you can look at the performance track record for 20 years and it's negative. But what's interesting is 2 years ago, when you looked at that 20-year number, it was positive. So was the 10-year. So was the 5-year. The last 2 to 3 years have been so detrimental to commodities that it has just killed the asset class across the board. We have some of those numbers in our reports as well. But it is interesting how they can move like that and how that current year really impacts.
So are they cognizant of that and reduce their exposure during those times by being in and out quickly?
Not so much. What they do is they maintain that portfolio position of around 20% that goes plus or minus, so they'll keep that roughly the same. But what they're doing is they're looking at it and saying your total portfolio has inflation sensitivity. And right now the inflation in the marketplace has all been deflationary. Everything has been coming down for so long, for several years now. So because of that, you're inflation hedging assets have also come down. So look, they've done exactly what they're supposed to do because the inflation environment has changed. The other side to it is when we look at inflation historically, it is volatile. And so when it goes through a period of spike, then you want to have those and it's too late to buy them then. So
how theoretically predicated is this strategy on inflation hedging assets?
Small.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like it would thwart the strategy all that much if you just leveraged the fixed income and had the equity component. Plus, we have a slight natural hedge on our inflation liabilities because of the cap on inflation that can be paid. There is a small hedge there, even though it's 3%.
I agree with Jim's concerns. And I frankly think that you shouldn't have two pie charts next to each other. One at 100%, which is what we're all used to. And the other one at like 230%, you know, when they do the two charts. It's kind of disingenuous.
Yeah, and
150%, come on.
Yeah.
It's pretend money.
I think they're doing that with the intent to be provocative, to provoke you to think about, hold on, I have 92% in one slice of the pie, that doesn't make sense. And so then you start to think about it, and then, it's because they're doing the leverage. Because they can use $2,000 to buy $100,000 worth of fixed income.
Yeah, and then they have a 3% requirement for cash for the margin call, but they say we should be 30 to 50%. And they were a little bit unclear as to exactly what they had.
Didn't you think it'd be very unusual for a retirement account to be buying stocks on margin like that? I mean, that's something I wouldn't even do myself.
Yeah, so the portion of the stocks is actually pretty small. They're really buying most of the margin. They're using most of the leverage to get the fixed income exposure.
You know, so what they're doing is they're looking at the portfolio of volatility, and they're saying, how do I get that volatility? Well, every time I buy stocks, I get a whole lot of volatility, so I don't need to own very much of those to get a lot of volatility. Bonds are really low volatility. I need to buy a lot of those, and that's why I have to leverage up that portion of the position to get it. So the leverage is really taking place on the fixed income side.
You are leveraging up a low-risk asset.
Right.
Well, I mean, you're paying interest on that leverage. You have to pay something for that. And if you're doing it on bonds, you're not going to make any much on bonds anyway. So that whole investment seems like it's bound to be flat.
Well, it's getting the leverage through futures rather than, they're not going out to the marketplace and borrowing to buy the $100,000 fixed income. They're buying a futures contract. So there is interest rate embedded in how that futures contract is priced, you're right, but it's not wiping out the gains that they're getting on that yield.
It can't be more than just basis points. It can't be a percentage of anything.
Right.
It's tiny. In this environment, it's very tiny.
I didn't understand their fee structure at all when he explained it. I couldn't understand what he was charging for that.
It's basically 35 basis points for them, and that would be something that we would take a look at in a search if we were to move forward with, you know, putting them against some competitors and seeing how they weigh out.
But it does give us an idea of where that market is.
Yes.
As far as fees.
He's talking about their management fee is 35, and then she had referenced the other fund-related expenses, and that's typical of all your strategies. So every you know, Dodge and Cox portfolio that we have, we're paying a management fee, and then we're paying additional, you know, custody and administrative expenses on top of that to make the fund work. So she was trying to give you that. When you see 35, you actually expect to see something more like 42, 43.
So it's close to average of what we're paying overall. It's actually slightly higher, but because I think our average is 33 to 35 basis points in the entire portfolio. So it's not that much out of whack.
Okay. So I think I'll take that back as probably some more topics we need to discuss about it, but I'm not feeling like hearing that it's off the table.
Enthusiastic, embracing.
No, I'm not hearing that either, but that's right.
Well, let me ask this question. Is there enough information now that next month after we hear emerging markets today, and we hear private equity next month, is there enough information on this risk parity to where you think you can say either yes or no? Or do we need to bring something back more to help you with your decision making?
I think if we have some like actual benchmark performance, you know, that might help me.
Past historical relative performance?
Yeah.
Can we get some of that?
Yeah, I think we can.
Okay.
Right now I would vote no.
I don't know what to think of this. A very unusual investment, unusual strategy. What were you thinking on this, like 5% of the portfolio?
Yeah, well, it depends on the asset allocation mix we select, but somewhere between 5 and 10.
Like 10 would be way too much.
I think what he said is right. You know, you see when plans get introduced to it, 5%, put your toe in the water, let's test it out, let's see what the reporting's like, let's see them go through a couple market issues and see how they weather it.
I'm not seeing any component that's different than what we already have in the portfolio.
Just the leverage.
But every equity you buy has leverage.
Yes, that's true.
And a lot of leverage in a lot of cases.
But this is direct leverage as opposed to balance sheet leverage.
It's on the fixed income side.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's the part.
It's not like they're shorting anything. It's not like we can put $30 million in and lose $10 million in 1 year.
We've done that.
I thought you might recognize that. it's none of those things. So it's a lot of the same beast kind of put in a corral differently.
It is, and because they try to target that volatility number, they're going to manage to that, which is interesting, because we go through and do like the asset allocation study and show you those numbers, and then we take a look at them quarterly, but we don't reallocate the portfolio to get them.
Right.
And you'll see the numbers today. We're low on our volatility side, which is strange because you look at the portfolio and we're overweight equities and such, and yet we're still low. How can that be? that's the market environment. It's, you know, historically, the equities over the past 5 years have been a very nice progression forward. They look at it and say, we don't have enough volatility in the portfolio. We need to leverage the fixed income to get that. It's a more active approach in that respect because it's done on a daily basis rather than quarterly, and it has that ability to take leverage that we as a plan aren't going to want to do. We're not going to. You're probably not going to want to see that on your balance sheet. So.
How easily can one move in into and out of this class?
Very, very liquid.
So it's very liquid.
Yeah. It's not a daily liquidity. It's probably a quarterly.
Okay.
It's either monthly or quarterly. Yeah.
So the equities in this risk parity, they're all international, like emerging markets and global?
It's global. And I think the pie chart in there had it that, yeah, as he was mentioning, 5% or something like that, small cap, 8% emerging market, yeah, the rest developed.
And the fixed income is more U.S.-based?
It is a blend also. It is primarily U.S.-based, but it is also international.
Global.
Like you mentioned, U.K., your treasuries.
Okay.
I didn't hear him say Greece.
One thing they didn't mention, what's the credit average credit rating of? Is it just treasuries?
It's sovereign.
Sovereign, I mean, yeah. Okay.
So it's pretty high. Okay. Emerging market debt would probably trade more.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw what Jeff commented, is that it's really not that much in there that we don't already have. It's just being actively managed to keep it all together, and somebody's corralling it differently.
It's a different perspective. I mean, yeah, instead of looking kind of strictly at returns, you're also looking at the risk, mm-hmm, and the volatility, mm-hmm, in the portfolio.
And possibly could take advantage of the fact, like Ed said, we don't constantly reallocate and move stuff where maybe we need to move some of it more often than we do.
But realize we can't achieve those risk-return profiles with our portfolio. Even though we invest in those assets, we can't achieve that profile with our current portfolio. No. You have to have leverage to make this work. Right. There's no doubt.
So, let's turn to the books. So we have two books for you today. The first one is the one with the colorful picture of the mountain as opposed to the grayscale picture of the mountain. So, behind tab one, if you turn to page two, a quick update on the front. I just want to provide you with this because we have grown pretty remarkably over the past few years, which has been great. A couple of changes are that we did indeed close the deal with SIS. So we're now representing $337 million in assets, 148 relationships. We had an offsite with the folks from SIS in the beginning of January to kick off the new year, and it went really well. I think it's going to be a great cultural fit. Very excited about having them on board, very excited about the capabilities they bring, and I think they're probably as excited or more so. So they're looking at it pretty optimistically as well. Several bullet points down, the fourth one down. We also, as a part of the deal, expanded the ownership base from 11 to 22 employees. So more employees are now owners of the firm, including yours truly. So that was a good thing.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So it continues to do well. And then the bottom bullet point highlights just our suite of offerings. And the suite of offerings that we have here are really designed to meet the different governance models that we see in the marketplace. So non-discretionary consulting is what we do today. We also do risk advisory services as a standalone, private markets consulting, discretionary management, and outsourced CIO. So depending on the plan type and what they're trying to accomplish, some essentially turn over the keys to us and say, rather than just provide us with your thoughts, just do it. And others continue with our more typical relationship as well. So we just highlight that as being able and adaptive to the market environment overall. If we take a look then, moving into the macroeconomics, if we turn to page six, we'll take a quick snapshot of the U.S., what we're seeing here. It's kind of the story of meh. It's okay growth, but no one's excited about it. And page six is interesting because if you think about what the Fed is trying to do here, these are kind of the numbers they're looking at. GDP is 2.1% for the one-year period ending September 30th. You roll that forward, the fourth quarter GDP came in at a
modest 0.7%. That was the first estimate. We'll see how that gets revised and finalized. But, you know, again, pretty modest growth. Inflation comes in at 0.5%. December came in at 0.8% this morning, where we had the producer price index was positive 0.4%. So no real signs of inflation. Moving down a little bit, 10-year rate. This is the 10-year U.S. Treasury at 2.3. That's come down quite a bit. Today it's 1.8. I think last week it was 1.59, broke through 1.6. So there's been a lot of buying of the 10-year Treasury. And then the unemployment statistics continue to improve. 4.9% is the latest U3 unemployment number. So why is the Fed interested in raising rates? And you look at this and you say, well, it's not to fight off too much growth, it's not to fight off inflation, and yes, unemployment is improving, but we know that there are plenty of people on the sidelines not even engaged in the labor force. So we kind of looked at December as saying, okay, so this was the Fed kind of painting themselves into a corner. They kind of had to do it because they had said so much in September and July about wanting to do it, so they did. December happens, they raise rates, January happens, and there's all sorts of economic turmoil around the world, concerns about future rate raises, and now we see that the market has priced in essentially zero rate raises, going 0% before March. No one's really expecting March to happen. It's a little above zero. And then what had been viewed as four interest rate increases for this year is more likely one or two tops. So I was actually confused about Victor's comments from Legato, because he was saying four, and that number has changed. That's come off quite a bit. So as a result, so if you don't have the fear of the Fed raising rates, which was a key reason why the dollar was strengthening, the dollar then subsequently weakens, and that helps our international equity exposures a little bit. Commodities seem to have therefore bottomed, so we're seeing an uptick in oil, not a lot, but we're at $30 today, not 26. An uptick in gold, an uptick in industrial metals, so they haven't recovered. I mean, they are still off dramatically from where they were. But we're seeing that this coincident indicator between where the strength of our dollar is and where commodities are working together here and appear to have bottomed, partially or principally driven by the Fed. So we'll continue to watch that and see how it plays out. U.S. earnings are not on this sheet, but U.S. earnings are always very interesting to me. And we now have about, 76% of the companies have reported earnings. 69% have beaten the earnings estimates, 49% have beaten their sales estimates. Those numbers are roughly in line with the five-year average, so typically you see that kind of earnings beat. The beat, though, is that they've only lost 3.2 or 3.4% year-over-year versus 3.7% year-over-year expected. So year-over-year earnings have decreased for three quarters in a row. So if we continue to watch this earnings recession, which is indeed what it seems to be playing out, then we're seeing that the U.S. economy or U.S. equities have kind of plateaued. And not only because the earnings aren't there, but because now the multiple you're willing to pay for those earnings has come down pretty significantly. So the 12-month forward P.E. ratio is more like 14.7, 14.8 around there. That's off from the 16 kind of range. And so, you know, the investing marketplace is looking at equities saying, well, you're not delivering me earnings growth. Why am I willing to pay up for that? I'm not. You know, I'm going to pull back. And so we see a flight to safety across most of the equities where instead of being on the high growth end of things, leaning more towards utilities or materials, places like that where it's safer. A lot of correction in the banks as there's been a lot of news about them not hitting their earnings estimates as well. So a really kind of bifurcated market right now we're seeing in the equity side. I think we can skip ahead a few pages. I'm trying to keep this part short. I'll jump to the page 21. Page 20. Page 20 at the top has the U.S. yield curve over time. The orange line at the top of this is where we were 10 years ago, September 30th of 2005, and since then it's continually moved down. Today we're the yellow curve, which is essentially the bottom from the 5-year on out. And so this is a handy reminder that in this whole time where we expected fixed income rates, rates to rise, haven't seen it, still not seeing it, doesn't seem to be happening. When we take a look at the bottom curve and we say, well, why might that be? Here is what the other developed nations are staring at. China is the top line there. The U.S. is the second from the top across just about the entire time range. Then Italy, then the U.K., then Canada, France, Germany, and Japan. And so the developed nations are experiencing much less growth, and as a result, their yield curves are much lower than ours. And then tie it back to what we were talking about with GDP, kind of not exciting numbers coming out of our GDP numbers. You would think that our economic growth is kind of merging more towards theirs, not really pushing away and not really getting out ahead of the curve. So it wouldn't surprise us to see these rates stay low, perhaps continue to go lower. It's hard to really believe that that's possible, but we can look around the world and see that it is indeed possible. Since this time, since this print, Japan has gone to negative interest rate policy, so they've actually brought their short-term rates down lower, more in line with Germany, which is the green line that you see below, and France as well. So that's an interesting time. Owning bonds in that market is going to be a good thing because that indicates an appreciation in price that's driving those yields down. And then let's jump ahead a little bit to international equities on page 34. And page 35 is going to show us the valuations. So page 35 is, I think, a better place to look. On the left-hand side here, we take these earnings estimates, the price-to-earnings multiple that we're paying, and we see the orange is the MSCI EAFE index, which is developed nations. The small cap is the green, and then that blue is emerging markets. And you can see how that emerging markets has been consistently lower for the past 3 years or so, noticeably lower, and then basically in line with the EAFE index prior to that. And so this is one of the indicators that we were looking at, saying when we consider the asset allocation decision and we think about the valuations around the world, emerging markets offer relatively attractive valuations. Maybe we should consider that for the portfolio. So that's one of the drivers of our thought there, and this latest macroeconomic outlook doesn't change that, it only validates it.
The emerging markets haven't done very well in the last few years.
While we're on the international scene, Russia and Brazil are in serious trouble. There's talk, is there risk of contagion moving into Europe?
We don't see it as such, no. So they've both been going through quite a bit of quagmire, each of them, for the past several years. So Brazil has their corruption issues, they have debt issues, they have hyperinflation. It hasn't spread to South America. Russia is dealing with Putin's policies, oil, lower price. They announced yesterday an agreement that they will cap oil, which is a funny agreement because their agreement is that they're going to cap oil production at January levels, which are peak oil production levels. So I don't know what they mean by that.
Capitalized would ever been.
They're having trouble getting Iran and Iraq to sign on.
Yeah. And that's the other part, is contingent on other countries joining that.
It's not going to happen without that.
Now, I think it's one of those things they're trying to jawbone the oil prices to go up higher. And
smoking something.
And I think Europe is a problem. I mean, Spain doesn't have a government. All they have are corruption scandals. They cannot get a majority government. And they're gonna have new elections, and they will still not have a majority government unless they divide the country, which means all your bonds over there aren't funded because they're all like retirement bonds. And there's no central government anymore.
Spain definitely has some issues ahead.
In Germany, you know, all the immigration issues.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Spain was certainly part of the pigs crisis whenever we were talking, you know, probably 2 or 3 years ago, you were probably looking at the pigs issues with Portugal, Ireland, and Italy, and Greece and Spain. So they were part of that. The improvements they've made since then have been dramatic. They are much
You should look up the English version of El País. Look at yesterday's edition.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, and that gives you the list of all the people in the government who've been indicted in Madrid and Valencia, and the problem with Catalans.
Uh-huh.
It's not a good situation, but my in-laws live over there.
I see. Well, I'm not going to challenge you on that.
I get updates.
I think I know what I'm going to be. Let's jump ahead to page 47. Take a quick look at the S&P 500 by sectors. Fourth quarter was a good quarter, so positive returns here. So materials, strong recovery there, 9.7%. High teens, healthcare, down towards the bottom, you're seeing utilities and energy. And then that's a bit of a reversal from the prior quarter, where utilities was the safe haven that we had been discussing. And then on page 48, quick look at the major indices. And you see that for the quarter, most of the U.S. equities in the upper left-hand quadrant, we're seeing the positive 3 to 7% kind of numbers. Below that, international equities, similarly, between, well, I guess, EM Latin America, shown to your point, Brazil, representing some of the problems there. But the rest of the market's generally positive. And then upper right-hand corner, fixed income, modestly negative. Basically flat, but modestly negative, and then commodities and the other asset classes in the lower right. So taking a look at that, you probably have a good idea of where the plan comes out, knowing that we are overweight equities. And if we turn then to tab 2, we'll take a look at those numbers. So first, just quickly on page 1, beginning market value of $1.7 billion. We see net withdrawals during the quarter, more than offset by the investment earnings, so ending market value of $1.75 billion. Page 2 gives us a couple of the nice charts on our asset allocation and market values. Page 3 takes a look at the current allocation versus policy. And I know we're doing the asset allocation work, but we are currently out of alignment with our existing policy. And anytime we see the nose within the IPS range column, which is the right-hand column there on that table, That's a flag to us. As fiduciaries, we're out of alignment with our policy, so this is something we need to be attentive to. We have policy ranges around each of these targets. So if we take a look at the second line down, domestic equity large cap growth, our current allocation is about 16.1%. The policy target is 11.3%, so we're 4.8 overweight. And we have a policy range that allows us to go up to 14.8%. So this would be an indicator that we need to rebalance the plan, and separate and apart from the asset allocation work. Similarly, we're out of alignment with the small cap. We have, we're basically bumping up against the policy range there, 4.7. And I think we're getting a no due to rounding. So we are slightly above the 4.7. In today's market, that may very well come back. So what I'd recommend is for our March meeting is that we develop a rebalancing analysis for the plan that we can give to you. You can take a look at and see how much money we would have to move from where to where to get this back to target. Of course, we'll still have underweights to the things that take time to get funded, like real estate and direct lending and infrastructure. So we have to have some overweights throughout the rest of the portfolio, but I think we need to be mindful of where we are with regard to our policy.
Do you need a motion on that, or
I don't think need
that was
from okay. Just accept for
that's a good idea.
Okay. Page 14, we'll take a quick look at relative performance. So the total fund gross of fees basis, 3.5% return, policy index 3.2, and then comparing to the other public funds in the investor force peer group, we rank in 13th percentile. So that's pretty nice. And then we have the one-year number and longer time periods as well. So this is all looking terrific on a relative basis. It's also looking very strong against the assumed rate of returns.
council 10 years, which includes the 2008 time period. So even with 2008 baked in, it's still a positive 6.2%. Looking down the column through the quarter, we see that we're getting outperformance on the U.S. equity side, outperformance on international equity, outperformance on fixed income. The real estate 3.3 against DJ US Select, the NC REIT index is basically about a 3.4%. So I think of the real estate exposure is basically in line. Direct lending underperformed there. So out of all the asset classes, we really enjoyed outperformance across all of them, which is a rare feat to see. Page 6 gives us the quick scan of how we're doing on a risk-return basis. And so we can see graphically in the chart that the total fund taking on slightly more risk and slightly more return than the policy index. But as we remember from the expected asset allocation, we're targeting more like a 7% return with an 11% standard deviation. So we're actually generating higher returns over these past 5 years, net of fees, higher returns with less volatility. So that's a good thing. And page 7 just hit some of the highlights of the managers. I think we discussed Dodge and Cox last time. They're having some personnel changes, and they broadcast these well in advance. So no additional changes since the last meeting, which is good. We heard from Legato. Jackson Square, I like keeping them on the radar because they're going through the transition period where they're separating their relationship with Delaware. Delaware has Jackson Square as the investment manager to a number of their mutual funds. They're going to cut that tie at the end of April. And when they cut that tie, the question is how much of the assets do they retain? And if they lose those assets, will it be disruptive to the company? And so we've worked with them very closely to ensure that it won't be disruptive, that they do have a plan in place, and they actually opened up 5 additional mutual funds on their own so that they'll be able to accept the money should the investors choose to withdraw from the Delaware funds and move to the new Jackson Square funds. Jackson Square funds are actually being housed, I believe it's by U.S. FEC, just so it'll be under a different moniker. So that'll be something we continue to watch through April and May. On page 8, a couple of points I wanted to make about international equity allocations. We have LSV, the quantitative manager, roughly in line with the index, and Pyramus, slightly above the performance. These are both benchmarked against the MSCI ACWI, is what we call it, ACWI, which stands for All Country World Index. That includes emerging markets. So that index has about a 20% emerging market exposure. And because we have these allocations to it, we have 18-19% of our portfolio in these strategies. 20% of that is in emerging markets. So we are already getting about 20% of 19%. So 3.8% of the portfolio is in emerging markets. So I wanted to highlight that because we're going to do the emerging market equity education session in a moment, because of the discussion about having a dedicated emerging market exposure, which is something we can contemplate. This has it embedded in terms of these two managers. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. On the fixed income side, pretty nice performance both from Dodge and Cox and PIMCO. PIMCO was negative, but it outperformed the index. Dodge and Cox was actually positive with some financials exposures, so they're very credit-heavy, shorter duration, and they were underweight treasuries. As you can imagine then, thinking through what happened in January, being underweight treasuries probably wasn't good. Being overweight credit probably wasn't good. Being overweight financials probably wasn't good. So the three things that helped them in the quarter probably go against them January and February to date. We'll see how it continues to play out. So on our January update, they generated 0.3% and the index generated 1.4, so they did indeed underperform for the month. Then we have our real estate exposures, our property fund. Only thing to note here is the American strategy had a return of capital, which I thought was kind of odd, and Rick, you probably spoke to them as well on that. That kind of caught my attention as
strange operationally, because they called the capital, presumably because they had deals to invest in. So they go through and they get the deals lined up, and then they call the capital so they can actually write the check. When they return capital, that means that a deal fell through or deals fell through. Something happened there. And so that's, these things happen. So it's not unheard of, but it's one of those things that we kind of keep a little tick mark in the back of our minds on what that means to us.
So I talked to them, and it's exactly what you just described. I think they committed or something like that, and they realized they didn't have the investments in the pipeline, and so they gave it back.
So I know in past quarters when I've talked to them about performance, they've said they think valuations are getting rich. They aren't willing to reach for these things. They're not willing to pay up for these deals. They'll let others pay them. So perhaps that's what they want to hear from those. I think someone else said that. On page 11, we have the progress of all of our closed-end funds. So the investments that we're making in Greenfield Gap, the direct lending, and infrastructure. Know that these take time to fully fund, and pretty soon we start getting capital back before we're fully funded, so always trying to manage that process. And this is part of what we'll be thinking about diligently going forward once we get to new asset allocation. Typically, we have to overcommit to these kinds of strategies because they do start returning capital before they've called it all. So we have to effectively think about allocating more to them. On page 13, we have the schedule of fees crossing to the managers. This is what Victor referenced when he said that our fees are showing 90 basis points, but they should be 77. So we'll go back and scrub this and make sure that we reflect it appropriately and that it actually is 77 or whatever it should be. So we'll take that back as an edit, make sure we're taking on that. Sounds like probably a change to the agreements.
It was about a year ago when we were discussing performance. They agreed to lower their fee schedule to us. And I can tell you that based on the last fee summary report that we put out, it's in line with 78 basis points or so.
Okay.
So it is what he said.
Okay. And was that a short-term thing? Was that
not in terms of the negotiation I had with him. It was permanent.
I think I gave that to you, but I'll check and I'll find the amendment and send it over to you in case you don't have it.
It was kind of an either-or thing.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Either it goes down permanently or you go away permanently.
We have the cards in our hand.
So yeah, I'll find the amendment and forward it off to you.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to turn a few pages forward through this. We don't normally go through the back part as much. But sticking on Legato, page 37, has some of the numbers starting on 37. And 38, the chart at the top shows the rolling performance. So I think this is a handy way of looking at how managers outperform and underperform. The rolling three-year excess performance is just that. That gray line is saying how much have they outperformed the index on a three-year basis, and update that three-year basis for us every quarter. And so you can see that they have had a period there back in 2013 where they had some pretty strong outperformance. It has since come back down, and they're back to about zero. So I understand the discussion and frustration that you've had. On pages 39 and 40, more performance charts. Page 40 has this risk-return dynamic that we were talking about in their book. They had done it on a since-inception basis. Here we have the three-year and five-year, and the numbers change a little bit. And here we're seeing on a three-year basis, this is also gross of fees, so modest outperformance on a gross of fees basis. If you factor in what they actually charge us, that would be below. Standard deviation on a three-year basis is actually higher, 15.6 versus 15.2. We'd call that about the same. I mean, that's pretty darn close. Five-year basis, modest outperformance here. 1.1% on a gross of fees basis, and then annualized standard deviation 18 versus 18.6, so slightly lower volatility.
So what do you think? I mean, what do you think of Legato?
You know, they aren't ones that we use in other plans, and when I look through their strategy,
it looks like we're probably getting about index-level performance at the end of the day, that they put together five managers, and when you put together five managers all in the same index, or all in the same asset class, you're probably going to get about index-like performance. So if that's the case, then why pay for it? I can just index it.
As a rule of thumb on these managers, how much grace do we give folks, or do you recommend we give them 1 year, 5 years, 10 years?
So it depends on the strategy, for one thing. But generally speaking, we would say that let's look at what their process is designed to do, and that's going to be an indicator of what your timeline is. If you're looking at a small cap growth manager and you're thinking about, you know, what's a business cycle, they tend to say we expect outperformance over a business cycle. So we take kind of a peak to trough to another peak, something like that, and look at it. And then we say, okay, so how have you done in good times? Have you done in the bad times? And judge them that way. And then make sure that they haven't changed their process along the way. We don't like to see that. So as long as they have a consistent process that we understand how it's going to perform, then we'll preach that, yeah, patience is merit, that they're doing what they said they would do, and this is a rough time for them, but they will recover.
So if we had to vote on Legato today, what would you recommend?
I wouldn't recommend you vote because we don't have a replacement in place. We don't have a plan for what we would do with the money, and I would want to think through those decisions before making that recommendation.
Thank you.
Tab 3 has the risk dashboard. I think it was especially interesting given our discussion on asset allocation. Page 1 of this report, chart number 1 is portfolio risk. This is the overall volatility. And this is an interesting chart because it's showing on the left-hand side our portfolio volatility for the fourth quarter is 9.1%, which is higher than our policy, 8.3. And why is that? Because we're overweight equities, and that's what's driving it. Typical peer is 7.4, so how do we compare against our universe? We're higher risk, which means then we would expect to underperform in January and February because that risk came off. What's also interesting is that 9.1 is much lower than what we agreed to accept at our last asset allocation, or what you agreed. I wasn't here then. But at that time, you were looking at accepting an 11 or 12% volatility. And so this is a way of looking at it saying, are we too light? Should we actually increase it? And that kind of discussion can start to be had. Portfolio equity beta is then taking a look at the equity component. We're higher on the risk side there. On the next page, we have interest rate duration. How sensitive is the overall plan to changes in rates? 1.7 versus policy of 1.9. That means for a 1% increase in rates, we would expect the portfolio to come down 1.7%. Approximately. And then credit spread duration is a measure of how much credit spread we have, and we have some in the portfolio there. So the risk dashboard, I think, is something we've talked about in the past very lightly, something I want to spend more time on going forward, because I think this is a really interesting thing in terms of the performance report really reflects what happened. It's totally backward looking, and it doesn't help us plan much for the future. The discussion on the macroeconomy helps us think about the future, of what could happen, what might happen, what the risks are out there, everything. I think the risk report really helps us understand how the portfolio is currently positioned and what risk exposures we're accepting. And at the end of the day, that's the decision we're making, is how much risk do we want to take on, thinking about where we're going to be in the future. And so as we spend more time on this component, I think this will make a lot more sense once we have the new portfolio in place or the revisions in place, and start measuring it in this way, thinking prospectively. At the very end of this report are all the definitions for all these graphs and how they fit together. They're brief definitions, but I think they are helpful. Starting on page 14, it is probably the smallest quant our printer can produce. So I'll have to ask them to see if we can do something about that. That's tough to read.
Provide magnifying glass.
Oh, and before I get into the emerging market deck, the CalPERS conference is coming up. I don't know if anyone's attending the CalPERS conference before.
The GA, Mark Warren.
Okay, great. Yeah. So we're going to put together a dinner with some of the managers. Kristen from Fidelity for Pyramus, and Terry Noble from American Realty. So some of the managers you have, I think, put together a dinner from what they can.
Great, thank you.
Got to report that on my 7th meeting.
You do.
You do.
You'll be forthcoming with that information.
Yes.
Because I'm trying.
Because Kelly chases us down if we don't do it right.
Okay, perfect.
I like those notifications. Thanks.
Yeah.
It's easier to chase.
Emerging Markets next?
Emerging Markets, yes. So this is the other book. So the asset allocation options that we showed you last time had anywhere from, I think, 5 to 10%. In emerging markets, of course, we can tweak that. And if we look at 5%, we can almost look at current plan as saying we're pretty darn close. In fact, it wouldn't take much to get to a 5% with a little overweight. So we're basically there to some extent. If we wanted to do 10%, we could talk about a dedicated strategy to just get emerging market exposure. And so let's take a look about why emerging markets are interesting to us. And happy to discuss any issues and concerns we have with investment risks or operational risks in this space. Page 4 begins with the definition, and it's funny because emerging markets is actually a term that was coined by someone in 1981, and so it doesn't really have a formal definition. It's this kind of colloquialism that has become a convention in our industry. So it's commonly used by the IMF and the World Bank as referring to emerging markets, but there is no one single definition of what those are. Page 5 talks about the types of investable markets, and we think about them in 3 tiers. Developed are the countries that you're used to thinking about. The emerging markets, more like economies that are growing, that are going through rapid growth and development, typically in population. And frontier markets, which are kind of a subset of the emerging markets in that they're growing as well and look to be the economic engines of the future, but they really lack the market accessibility. So the frontier kind of implies this, you know, trailblazing that needs to happen to really make them accessible. The emerging markets have investment risk, they are less efficient, and so fundamental research in this arena matters and really add value. Page 6 provides you with the 20.
Can I ask you a question? In the concept of emerging markets, are you thinking about markets that we're going to sell to, or markets that we're buying from, or markets with resources?
Markets that we would invest in, and many of them are resource rich. In fact, if you take a look at page 6, you'll see the countries specifically listed out. So these are countries like China. The big line item there, Qatar and United Arab Emirates, are both considered emerging market. You can think about what they are, the oil-producing countries.
So wait, is that energy or is that bank finance? In those two, Qatar and...
So this is mainly their oil-driven.
Okay.
And what this is a chart showing GDP per capita. So one of the handy ways of thinking about what makes an emerging country is where are they on GDP per capita? And if you think about where we are, we're kind of a $17 trillion economy in the U.S. with a population of 300-some million. And if you just divide those two, you can figure out what our GDP per capita is. That's the same metric that we're doing across the board here. But whereas we would be in the $50,000, $55,000 range, these countries can be more in the $1,000 to $2,000 range, and then, well, you can see that, or a $10,000 range in Qatar and United Arab Emirates, much higher than the 40, and Qatar is over $100,000. So small population that generates a lot of oil.
And that's still a little deceptive because that asset is probably owned by the government, and they're dividing it by the people. But the people don't necessarily have that income.
Exactly, exactly. And so it's a rough proxy
by which we measure all the countries in the world. And then you think about that, and like, well, that's why there's no simple definition of what is an emerging market. Most managers look at South Korea and say there's nothing emerging about it. It's emerged. It's as easy to access investments in South Korea. You look at the country, the companies there. I mean, we're driving their cars, we're buying their TVs and everything else. They're a major country.
Do you think that country Iran will come into this picture in the near future? Iran?
Frontier market.
Well, frontier market.
Yep. So very difficult to access. So getting capital in and out of Iran is very difficult for us. So we would look at that as frontier. But over time, probably. But it might be 30 years or something. We don't know.
Look at the difference between an investment in Taiwan and an investment in Greece, and they looked exactly the same on your chart.
Right.
Yeah, that's like somebody should allocate those countries in different categories.
Well, again, this is just introducing the concept. I'm not Greece or
divided population.
So Russia also falls out on here. Indonesia, India. You see how small a dot India is, and why is that? Well, their economy is just getting going.
And most of it is not recorded either, right? I mean, cash business type.
Right. So capturing that is pretty key. Although they try to approximate it, I'm not sure how they are. H7 is what MSCI uses. So they set up their framework, and you'll see that at the top, they're just looking at the country GNI, gross national income per capita, is what a developed country falls into. Company size, security, liquidity, all those are easy to capture metrics across all of these markets. The next section, though, the bottom section, market accessibility criteria, this is much more subjective. And so we're saying things are very high or significant. Openness to foreign ownership. Well, in the developed countries, openness to foreign ownership is very high. We can make investments in Germany, France, and Japan, and such, no problem, Canada. Emerging, it's significant. Frontier, at least some. So there we go, at least some. That's not very encouraging. Ease of capital inflows and outflows. Efficiency of the operational framework. Stability of the institutional framework. So those are more qualitative, more subjective. And also active managers in this space look at these same things and think about them. And they'll say, we're not investing in that country.
What does efficiency of operational framework mean?
That is how easily we can get money in and out. How can we, what is the custodial network there? So when we think about investing abroad, the custodial banks have to have relationships in those countries to actually process the transactions. It's not operational. Those are operational. So this is how MSCI thinks of it. Page 8 gives you another indicator. So here we are again with the details outlined, kind of what drove the chart here, but also the HDI, which is the Human Development Index. And this is a blended index capturing how long people live based on life expectancy at birth, their education, income per capita indicators. Higher score of country is better than a lower score. So on the right-hand side, we have the developed countries, the G7, Canada, France, Germany, Italy as a developed country. I'll pause on that one for a second. Japan, United Kingdom, and US. You can see our HDI indicators, where they come out, 0.9s, plus or minus. Many of the emerging market countries aren't quite there yet. India is at a 0.61. South Korea is at a 0.9. So again, thinking about what makes an emerging market country. But you also see something interesting here, which ties into the chart on page 10, which is how much of global GDP is generated by these countries. And so here we see the United States is 22.5% of global GDP. Developed international, another 38. Emerging markets is 35. So it's these 23 countries that are really generating a lot of the economic growth. And on page 11 then takes that chart and says, okay, what about just the growth rates? Where are we seeing growth come out? And this is it. The orange bar is the emerging frontier countries. consistently positive through each of the last 10 years. So when we think about investing in equities, equities are a tie to economic growth. Economic growth is GDP, so equities are the best way to access that economic growth. And recognizing that we are kind of in this slow growth environment, the rest of the developed world is slower than we are. Emerging market countries are the growth engine of the future. Shouldn't we be thinking about how to tap into that growth? So I'll skip ahead a few pages. I do like those words in the interest of time. Page 16 has the case for why invest in emerging markets. Demographics, rapidly growing populations combined with affluence, rapidly growing middle class populations. So not only is the population itself growing in a lot of these countries, but the transition from lower middle class to middle class, or poverty levels to lower middle class to middle class, are terrific drivers of the economic growth there, because these are the people who transition from having to fend for food and clothing to transitioning to cell phone usage. Cell phone usage is rampant, so that's one thing that is growing very quickly. And it's interesting because these countries are still the infrastructure spend that we made here in the U.S. Why even put up landlines? Let's put up a tower that reaches everyone in the community kind of thing. So that kind of growth is very dramatic. You'll see equity managers highlight these demographic trends on colorful charts about how fast populations are spreading and how they're growing. The third point, international trade and capital flows. These countries are recognizing that they need the money to come into their countries to invest, to continue to grow and develop, so they are open to it more and more, and that's a good thing. And as a result, then, the investment in their countries is producing goods for all of us as consumers, which in the U.S. we are not shy of consuming. And then commodities, the bottom point is that many of these countries are rich in specific commodities that are being exported elsewhere. And so we saw that for years with China growing and developing, and how much coal and iron ore was being sent to China. That has obviously slowed down quite a bit, and that's a key driver of why commodities have come off. But nonetheless, they are rich in natural resources of various types, so that's a key driver as well.
I have a friend in Poland that was on the landline list for a phone for 7 years and got his cell phone before that.
Where was this at?
Poland.
It's better for him to have his cell phone anyway in case the Russians move in.
And China's bought all our scrap metal, they'll be shooting it back at us someday.
Pages 18 and 19 get a little bit into our capital market assumptions. And we touched on this earlier in terms of the valuations and performance. The rolling 3-year performance for emerging markets has turned negative, as we see in the middle chart. So looking at the current investment period looks challenged. On page 19, when we take a look at some of the constructs to build our assumptions, we're looking at the bottom line is a real return number across U.S. large cap, small, developed international, small developed international, and emerging markets. And you can see how strong those return assumptions are for emerging markets. Also higher volatility, though, too. So we're seeing that volatility is about 23%.
For emerging markets? And what is it for everyone else?
It's in the neighborhood of 17-18% for the U.S. For U.S. large. For small, it's also about 22-23%. Um,
U.S. large 15, U.S. small 20. And then 21 and 22 just have a couple of key risks and how the risks can be mitigated. So we think of the key risks as being political, there's political instability in a lot of the emerging market countries. We think of that's part of the value add that active management can play, so we don't recommend indexing an emerging market exposure. Government involvement in corporate governance. I think, Jeff, as you pointed out, some of those enterprises are state-owned enterprises. How can you invest in them? Or what if they're private and they become state-owned? Don't you as an equity shareholder lose out? You do. Again, that's part of what is viewed as the economic stability in these countries, which ones to invest in, and how active management perceives it. Capital financing, bankruptcy, sovereignty and corporate risks, liquidity risks, corruption, conventions and standards. Across all of these risks, we're seeing them improve over time so that these markets are more and more attentive to the capital markets and wanting to attract capital, and they know the steps that they have to take to do so. So they've made quite a bit of improvement across these, but they don't go away, and it's very country specific, and again, in some cases, company specific as to what your risks are. Let me pause there and see what questions you have.
So what are you thinking might be an upper percentage limit of where we could go? It sounds like we're almost at 5 already, just with what we have.
Yeah, I think the most aggressive model that we showed you had 13.
Correct, FFP4. And you generally it ranges from between 5 and 13%, 5 on the low end.
So you think the climate has improved over the last couple of years for investing in emerging markets?
The last couple of years haven't been very good.
Yeah.
So the past year and a half has not been, the prior periods have been.
So that 13, then you would add the 3.8 on top of 13 in those scenarios?
No, it'd be 13 total.
So they'd be inclusive.
We have the historical returns on page 26.
So what kind of industries, you know, come to mind when you say emerging, you know, markets? What kind of sectors are we talking about?
It can be pretty much across the board. It can be all sectors. Some tend to be heavier than others. They tend to be lighter than in financials. Financials tend to be more global banks kind of thing, so you tend to see more of that in the developed nations. Technology is a big driver, so it's growing and continuing. You see a lot of the materials and commodities producers. Manufacturing is taking root in a big way, so the natural progression tends to be that the countries go through sort of textiles and basic industries as they grow in sophistication and migrate to more sophisticated. In fact, I think China is a good example of that because they are now transitioning away from the lower cost, lower value add manufacturing to the higher end, and they're letting more of those lower value add manufacturing jobs migrate to Vietnam and other places like that.
The chart on page 25. Financials are higher in the emerging markets than they are in the rest of that. That doesn't seem intuitive to me.
No. And I just gave the counter argument to why I would think that would be counterintuitive as well to me.
And I agreed with you when you said it, which is why I'm asking.
Donna, what are the chances that they can charge a lot higher margin in non-credit quality?
Really possible.
Yeah, it's guaranteed.
And
yeah.
Also, you know, it could be that it's just so concentrated in just a couple of countries that moves it. I don't know.
This is also relative, right? This is
financials as a portion of the emerging markets is a larger component. So if we took all of the orange bars, they should add up to 100. So the
I just really thought it was going to be energy.
Right, yeah. But so that I think that would explain it in terms of if you look at the size of the financial sector across the emerging markets versus size in developed nations, the size would be larger in developed nations. The relative proportion of the equity index across the emerging markets is higher than financials. I think that's what I'm sure we're showing. The performance on page 26, I think, is interesting. Because it does run hot and cold. You can see in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, these numbers are just off the charts, only to get half of it back in 2008. And so what happened in 2008? Oh, right. So, there was that global financial crisis thing. It hit emerging markets very hard. 2009 is an incredible rebound, followed by 2010. So definitely a volatile cycle. And it's very sensitive, or it had been very sensitive here, to what was going on in the rest of the world. And in 2008, when it was coming down to half, or actually when it was leading up to it, in 2007, there was a lot of discussion in the investment community about had emerging markets decoupled. I don't know who put that word out there or what phrase, who's responsible for that, but they put it out there that emerging markets had decoupled, and it caught on like wildfire. And everyone was explaining that emerging markets had decoupled because their consumer base was now strong enough and vibrant enough that they could be a self-sustaining economy, that they weren't reliant as much on the U.S. and other developed nations. And then 2008 happened, it's like, oh no, they're actually closely tied to us. So it's a higher volatility exposure to equities because of that. I think that tie continues on. 2013, 14, and 15 are the 3 years, Mr. DeMartini's point, that that's not been the place to invest. And so it has gone through.
I know that because my wife invested in a mutual fund and lost quite a bit of money on it. I told her not to do it, too. So.
Yeah, but don't you like to buy when they're friendless?
Is that why you had to buy her the Lamborghini?
That was for me. I bought her a Maserati.
Yes. What is the difference between the MSCI Emerging Market and the Russell 3000 Index? Because there's almost an inverse relationship. If you look at the line on 2004 and the line on 2013, they like flop over on the performance.
So, to answer your question, the Russell 3000 is a broad measure of U.S. equity markets. So the Russell 2000 is the small cap stocks. The 1000 is the mid and large cap. And you put together the 3000 gives you the.
So that's U.S. only?
Yes.
The rest, okay. So it's comparing the emerging markets to the U.S.
Right.
I don't know if you can categorize these investments this way because things are so interdependent. And you know, what happens over in the EU impacts everyone all over the place. What happens in our election impacts everybody. It all is kind of jumbled. I think we have to, our offshore investment should be premised on proven companies or countries like Sweden, you know, who aren't having these enormous challenges. And I don't think it's going to be an easy time internationally or even domestically for some time. So I don't beat the drum to say invested Venezuela, although they're not on this list. Shouldn't be on any list, but.
So I didn't hear that completely. You think we should invest in Venezuela?
No.
You don't?
No.
Okay.
No, they should be on no list.
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, so you may absolutely be right on that. What I can tell you is that the global economic growth continues to come out of these countries, and regardless of how fast or slow that is, the trend is really compelling. These are the countries that have the population growth. They are opening their markets. There's a lot of key drivers that we as the developed nations have already gone through. And so they're looking at us as the model of saying, we want to get to that. We want to get our people to that standard of living and so on and so forth. How do we do it? And a big part of it is the capital inflows that allow them to invest and to do it. And so if we can tap into that, then we can get a better differentiated source of growth than if we just invest in developed markets alone.
Now, are there some firms, investment firms, that focus totally on emerging markets?
Yes. Yeah. Or international, and they think of how they get to those exposures differently.
So there's mutual funds of this deal and those exclusively. Which didn't work out for her.
And you can imagine that we're talking about the asset class overall. But like if we were to talk about U.S. equities as an asset class, we could really quickly get into, well, there are large cap, mid cap, small cap managers with growth and value bias and all those kinds of things. And that's the way with this, that once you start getting into individual managers, you start learning about how they position their portfolio and how they think about these things. And so there will be higher quality ones that say, we're not going to touch in Brazil or what have you. Other ones who are looking at it saying, Brazil has just corrected 50% or more. I want to get into that. That's my future return. So they can really run quite a range.
And that's the manager's call.
That's the manager's call.
At random, we decide what the manager's call.
That's right. So again, an educational session. If you heard anything that is a deal breaker in terms of considering this or the asset allocation work, that would be something that wants to know. If it's suitable as an asset class, then we can continue modeling the options like we were outlining in the feedback that you gave us last time, continue working with that, and then it becomes a decision about whether we need to have it as an explicit mandate or embedded in our international equity mandates. Takes what's most efficient.
And you do have some of your other clients are invested in this class, and you have, you're already working with some managers in this class.
Yes.
Four of the potential new mixes have a very, very small increase additionally into this asset space. It's only a couple of the potential candidates that have a significant increase into this space.
And we're right now at 4 or 5%?
We are right now at 3.7%. And again, four of the six allocations on the table have a 5% allocation to the space, so we're only looking at another 1.3%.
Is this class right now embedded in to our international?
Correct.
So you'll just continue moving forward without any, I mean, you don't need a motion on this one, right?
Don't need a motion on this. I'll be coming back to you next month with the private equity presentation. That educational presentation will be provided by Pathway. They are a private equity funded funds manager out of San Diego. And I think they do a nice job with their due diligence and just down to earth people, I think. We'll have a good conversation like you did today with the folks from Panacora. So, and if you like what you heard today on risk parity, I'm going to try to replicate that.
And I think we'll make an attempt next month to shore up the asset allocation, but if we don't, then we can get you whatever else you need going forward. But we'll make an attempt after the discussion on private equity.
Well, there's no good reason not to do that, right?
I mean, I would hope so.
If you say we're out of compliance, it doesn't stop anything else we're doing if we balance.
No, the only thing is we have kind of a cushion now that Graham has gone back and he said he will use the 7.25% discount rate based on the current asset allocation. And so we have that in our hip pocket for at least one more year. I wouldn't suggest continuing that assumption for very much longer. But starting July 1st, if we don't make a decision, then the county is just going to start paying the rate based on the 7.25% discount rate. And we'll use that for a year. If that's, I'd rather, like you say, I'd rather make a decision as sooner than later, but we don't have to rush into this.
absolutely if we don't want to. That's my message.
But at very minimum, we would need to rebalance.
Yes, absolutely.
At very minimum.
So that's actually two discussions then.
Yep.
Next go around.
But I think the latter will be predicated on the former.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So next up is something from you.
Thank you. Okay, so this is the quarter four auxiliary investment report. I'll go through this pretty quick because we do have a couple discussion and action items. Quarter four, not only on an absolute basis, but on a relative basis, was very good for our portfolio. The managers added in total about $5 million in value added above the benchmark. The big winners were Jackson Square, Legato, Pyramus, and Dodge & Cox Fixed Income. Over the years, the portfolio, over the 2015 calendar year, the portfolio added $1.5 million, and Pyramus Global added the most. They added $4.8 million in value, and the rest of the managers actually detracted from value over the 2015 calendar year. So I just wanted to let you know that Pyramus appears to have rebounded very well over the last 18 months. I know that they were on our radar about 2 years ago, but they have really, really rebounded handsomely over the last 18 months. The investment fee summary, that's something that I generally have brought to you in the past, but I think we're going to have to lag that at least one quarter now. I think going to the meetings the third Wednesday of the month, we were really right there on the cusp of being able to get this information from our alternative managers, and now pushing the meeting date up investment-wise from the fourth Tuesday to the third Wednesday has kind of pushed that envelope. And so I think what we're going to do is we're just going to start bringing you lagged results the next quarter.
Did you skip the first section?
The value added, this one right here? No. I mean,
I wanted to ask a question about that third paragraph. Are those numbers correct?
As far as I know, they're correct. I took them right off the report. Yep. Okay. Yes, they are. And they're on here, too. The alternative investment report, just to let you know, the commitment and investment periods are over for Raven One, White Oak, and Medley, which means that we're starting that investment harvesting period, and we're expecting a lot of cash back over the next 6 months to a year from these three managers. And it's already started. Medley has started, and I believe Raven has started as well.
White Oak.
So we're going to start getting a lot of cash back, which makes the discussion of rebalancing even more important going forward. And the asset allocation decision as well, where we should
where
be directing that money. And I also think personally that this is going to be a good time. We're going to really start to get a good sense of how these direct lending investments has performed as we start to get this cash back. I think we'll really get a feel for what the returns are in these investments.
And we'll have an opportunity to roll back into those. Is that my understanding?
We are. I kind of put that on hold for a month or two until we get this issue clarified. I think we need to know where we're going combined with the rebalancing before we decide what we're going to do with that. So we'll talk about that next month more.
We may have additional managers for inspiration.
Yeah. And then the cash flow report, that's fairly self-explanatory. I won't go into that. Okay. I will just move on if you don't
Please.
Mind that. So moving on to item 9A, this is a discussion and action item regarding the cost of living adjustment. Staff's recommendation is going to be to approve Chiron's recommendation for a 3% cost of living adjustment to Stansera retired monthly members benefit beginning April 1st, 2016. And as Graham alluded to last month, the reason for the large increase in the cost of living index in the Bay Area is mainly due to housing. And we have an agenda item right after this where we discuss the appropriateness of the index. But even if the board decided that they wanted to do something different at some point in time, we need to approve this now so we can get this on the books and get moving with this. So whatever we do, this is going to be something that will ultimately be decided before next year.
But the Social Security COLA was zero, right? this year for Social Security? It was zero?
No raise for Social Security.
Zero. No increase. What? Zero.
Zero. Yeah. No. No, zero.
Yeah, and I think
so. You're agreeing.
Yeah.
Don't say no to him. I want to argue with that.
And the veterans were zero also.
It's a few times.
The veterans' pensions were zero. So
we're basing this, and you know, it's something that doesn't really apply to this area.
Well, you might be surprised. Let's wait till the next agenda. I mean, I'll be very. I was surprised. Huh?
I'd read the agenda on the next one.
Okay.
I don't see that we have any choice except not to continue.
I'll move that we raise the cost of living 3%.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries.
Just a serious discussion.
All right. Item 9B, this is the cost of living adjustments for the appropriate index. This is a discussion and action item, and staff today will be recommending to take no action on this issue. So last month, staff was asked to look into the possibility of another index and how well the current index reflected what was going on in our county. And so what the first thing we did was we decided, okay, how should we answer this question? And the first thing we looked at was, can we legally do this? And so if you take a look at a literal reading of the retirement law, all the retirement law says is that each year, as shown by the then current Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers for the area in which the county seat is situated, that's what you'll calculate the COLA based on. The Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes the counties constituting the Bay Area Index as Alameda, Contra Costa, Marin, Napa, San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Clara, Santa Cruz, Solano, and Sonoma. Obviously, Stanislaus is not in that index. And so that leads us to believe literally that we can use a different index. We ultimately, if the board decided they wanted to go down this path in a little more depth, we would ask you to weigh in on this. But we think as it stands right now that legally it's not an issue. However, whether it is or isn't, there's a couple other questions that need to be asked. The second question is, how well does the current index reflect what is actually happening in the county? And the answer is, statistically, mathematically, it does a very good job, believe it or not. And I'm not going to get into the math statistics that were used, but we did a simple regression analysis, and what we learned through the regression analysis is that the San Francisco Bay Area Index explains nearly 90% of the change in inflation in this area. Now, that's an interesting statement that I just made, because what we used to determine our inflation in this area was something that we got off the DOT, the Department of Transportation's website. And for some reason, the DOT, and I don't know, Mandy, I don't know, you might be able to weigh in on this, I don't know if you look at this, but for some reason, the DOT website has inflation figures for each county in the state of California. I happened to stumble across it on the internet, and so we had 9 data points from 2006 to 2014 that the DOT said were the inflation metrics in this area for each of those years. And we lined those side by side with the San Francisco Bay Area inflation and did this regression analysis. And again, what we found is that the San Francisco Bay Area index explained almost 90% of the change in our inflation according to the DOT website. We also looked at several other indices. We looked at the LA index, we looked at a West Region index, and these are all reported on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website. And we looked at an all U.S. city average. The explanatory power in all three of those indexes didn't even come close to the San Francisco Bay Area. Also, the significance of the San Francisco model was extraordinarily high relative to the significance of the other indexes. One of the things that we found out when we did this analysis, though, is that there's an interesting correlation between the San Francisco Bay Area and Stanislaus County inflation. And what we found was that when inflation is high in the San Francisco Bay Area, our inflation tends to run lower here. And in those cases, we would be overpaying the retirees. When inflation is low in the San Francisco Bay Area, our inflation tends to run higher here. And in that case, we would be underpaying the retirees. So what I did was, if you look at, just before I came in here, I didn't think about doing this, but I looked at the average, or the statistics on that page right here in attachment one. So I looked at San Francisco and I compounded all those percentages, and then I compounded all the percentages for the county in the far right. And had we been using, well, we've been using the Bay Area, and what I found was that if I compound the San Francisco index, I get an increase in benefit of 24% over that 9-year period, 24.01 to be exact. And then I compounded the counties over that same period, and the benefit would have compounded to 24.4%. So the overall compounded inflation in this area, according to the DOT's website, was actually higher over that 9-year period than it was in the San Francisco Bay Area, believe it or not. I know it's not what I expected to see, but it's what the data bore out for us.
Okay, Rick.
Yes.
I get on attachment one, I get San Francisco's 3.4, LA's 3.29, West Region, U.S. City Average, County. So is that Stanislaus County's
according, cost of living? According to the DOT website, and I keep saying that because I don't know, and I could not find the DOT's source for their data. Yeah. I don't know where it came from.
That's so federal DOT?
Yes. So I don't know where it came from.
Okay.
I'm a little concerned about it, but it's there for the world to see. And they also published that same statistic for every county in California.
Right. Why would that reflect anything but transportation costs?
I don't know. I don't know what that. There was no documentation as to what comprised that, but it has to be more than transportation costs because of the correlation effects between San Francisco, the BLS, and the county. If it were just transportation costs, the correlation coefficients would not be as strong. There's no way that the San Francisco Bay Area could explain the amount of the change in inflation in this area if it just included transportation.
We haven't had that kind of a change.
Well, that I don't know, and that's why I say I don't know. I can't, there's nothing for me to validate the DOT's inflation numbers.
Yeah, they could be basing it on statistics from various other metropolitan and taking, you know, 80% of this and 20% of that, and creating, you know, sort of their own hybrid number.
They could.
Yeah, I don't know how reliable this report, the DOT report, is.
Right.
I think we have used it just as another measure of, like, you know, when we look at our property taxes and sales tax,
sure,
forecasting, and so forth.
The point is, though, is that because of the large explanatory power in the Bay Area Index, there has to be some similarities in the way the numbers are calculated. If not, they could not be that strongly correlated. So they have to use a lot of the same information to calculate it. But again, I couldn't find any documentation at all. So I guess what I would suggest is that we continue to watch this situation, and I mean, I don't see any chance for a new index to rear its head by the BLS at any time in the near future. So,
I agree.
How many of the Valley counties are 37 Act retirement systems?
20.
No, Valley. Sacramento.
There's eight of us, yeah. I think.
I think most of them are Sacramento, San Joaquin, us, Merced, Tulare, Fresno. That's seven. You probably have one more.
Kern is in Kern's field.
Yeah.
So I think what I would like to know is, what do they use for cost of living? Do they all use the LA or Bay Area?
So I know some of them.
Has anybody done something different?
So Sacramento, yes. The answer is yes. And I'll tell you which two are. Sacramento and San Joaquin and us and Merced use the San Francisco one. Fresno uses the West Region Index. Bakersfield, Kern, I don't know what Marin does. Bakersfield, Kern uses LA. And LA uses 70%, believe it or not, they have got a law on the books, 37 Act code. They use 60 or 70% of the actual change in the index of the LA County area. So in other words, if inflation was 2%, they would use 1.2% for their inflation for their retirees. So they use a subset or a factor based on the actual change in inflation of the LA index. So those are really the only two. Fresno and LA are not the norm. Fresno uses the all West region index, and LA uses a percentage of the LA index. Those are the two ones that are out there that are different from everybody else. So there is a possibility to use, I think, to use a subset of another index. But there's no way, based on these numbers here, and assuming that the DOT's numbers are correct, there is no way I could recommend switching from the Bay Area index and going to something else. It just wouldn't make any mathematical sense at all. And it wouldn't be defensible, at least from my perspective.
I would just like to know what the county figure is. But, you know, we have like 30,000, 35,000 commuters every day that go over to the Bay Area, so.
Okay, I think we should table it because you looked into it and there's nothing compelling.
I couldn't defend it, absolutely not.
We don't need to take any action on that.
Okay.
I think we should ask the federal government to use it for Social Security.
Yeah.
I think what I'd like to do...
Oh, now that you're right on the north side?
Yeah, pretty much.
I think ultimately what I'd like to do is continue to monitor the West Region Index and the U.S. All-City Index and see if the strength of the relationship increases over time. But and also, I've only got 9 data points, too. I mean, 9 data points is not a lot, but I think it's a good enough start to give us an idea of if there is any causation effect or correlation effects between the Bay Area and us.
What are we doing with this now?
Nothing.
Nothing. No action.
Unless you want to.
Just informational at this point. Just informational at this point.
Okay. All right. Item 9C, this is a discussion and action item regarding Stansara bylaw revision, and I will let Kelly Gomes handle this one.
Okay, 9C, discussion and action items. Staff recommendation is to accept the amendment requested by County Council. I'll give you a brief overview of what it is. In this section of our bylaws, they were written to address the remedies for errors for individual members, active, deferred, retirees, but not any one large group as a whole. After reviewing our bylaws, County Council requested the amendment before you today. In brief, the concern was to make sure that there was nothing in our bylaws that would preclude the rights of Stanislaus County or any of our other plan sponsors to recover retirement contributions and interest when applicable. The caveat requested was reviewed by our council and is before you today for approval. Other minor clerical changes were made and are before you as well. Any questions?
Can I say something?
Sure.
I glanced it, but I found some errors. So, for example, in page number 18, under 4.4, the second paragraph, last sentence is, it says, after the effective date of this regulation, should it be bylaw instead of regulation?
It's one and the same. It could be either.
Yeah, because the other page I saw that you crossed out regulation.
No, you're right.
You're right. We missed it.
We found one where we changed it to bylaws.
Yeah. So this one also.
No, you're right.
Bylaw.
You got to realize that this document is very extensive and it's very difficult to pour over this every word.
And we keep working on it.
We do. In fact, County Council found a couple of those minor clerical things that Kelly brought up, and you just brought up another one.
Can I go ahead with some other things?
I'll tell you what.
Not only right. One.
Go ahead.
Okay. Under 4.5, under A, it says, upon receipt of completed distribution of the word half found twice.
Okay, where is it?
It's just right below
that. How about if we do this? How about if we do this exercise once every 1 or 2 years? Why don't, when we do this again, let's cover these things? Because I could probably spend 2 or 3 hours and find little clerical errors in this thing.
Errors.
Oh, yeah, I kept finding them, but
you've got to stop at some point in time.
Yeah.
Why can't we approve the policy as recommended by County Council and include the typographical errors that anyone has seen in the
and motion. Submit them to us?
We
can do that. How about if we do that?
Sure.
As long as it's
just typographical.
All right.
As long as it's just typographical or...
Right, not substance.
Or grammatical?
Yeah.
Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Just for the record, that was Grover who, and Mike...
Lynch Grover.
Lynch Grover, thank you.
Oh, we don't want a Lynch Grover, yeah. Do you know where the term Lynch came from?
Yes.
Jim verified it.
Yeah, I did. I found it on the castle in Ireland.
Galway.
All right. Item 9D, Information Technology Solution Project Update. Kathy Herman.
Okay, this is just an informational item. Linnea has completed about 60% of phase two, which is requirements documentation. All the functional requirement sessions have been completed, and we are beginning the review process. So several people are reviewing these documents, going back to them, having more discussions. But as you can see from the little graph up above, the first box up here, we are still on track for our original schedule of putting out our RFP. So we are moving forward. Staff is doing everything they can to basically stop what they're doing and do their reviews, so we're not holding up the next person to look at them. They've come up with some good ideas, and staff is being as detailed as possible to make sure we get everything in it we need. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of information on that.
Thank you.
They've been quite easy to work with, and it's been nice. I mean, I can see positive results coming out of this stuff.
So you expect to be underway with a vendor by July?
It's a scary thought, but yes. Yes, it is. We are moving forward.
By the way, we are going to have at least one vendor come in and do a demo before we even put out an RFP. And if anybody is interested in that, let us know. I'm kind of excited.
Why would you be doing that before?
Because we want to try to make sure that we are covering all our bases and that we're going to be asking for what we need to be asking for, that we're not forgetting anything.
Isn't that what your consultant is doing?
It's the consultant's idea.
You really risk...
We will give everybody a chance that wants to come in and do that if they want. We've already talked about it. But we don't want to miss anything in the RFP that we may want later on.
It is a risk.
We can talk about it more, Donna. I think it'll be okay, because there's so much information out there, and we're trying so hard to get what we need in the RFP so the vendor has a clear view of what they're bidding and we have as few change orders as possible. But it's hard to know what we don't know at this point.
Is there such thing as a two-stage RFP?
Yes.
Yes, we can do this.
Almost like a design-build thing where they would come in and tell you everything.
There's more than one way to do this completely, yes.
Yes.
So we can be very careful about how we go forward.
You could do an RFI, mm-hmm. and then have that be open to everyone. And then from that pool, you can do an RFP and send it to select vendors. That is one option.
We'll have a conversation, okay. Absolutely.
I understand your concerns, and we actually thought about that.
Yeah.
We talked about it with the consultants, and they thought it was okay, but we can definitely entertain what you have to say.
Can legal counsel weigh in on it?
We can have Fred weigh in on it.
Just protect the system.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no one to look and say you're preferential.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And that was our concern as well.
And I wouldn't assume that the consultant is completely unbiased.
Oh, absolutely
never.
Not.
Never.
But I think they do understand how these public pension systems work, because they've dealt with so many. So I don't know if they would necessarily, unless Stanislaus has some unique issues about RFPs, I don't necessarily think they would steer us wrong in terms of risk that way. But again, we can vet that further.
Sounds good.
Okay. And then our final item is item 9E. This is the Ledge legal update. I apologize. This is Dawn's issue, and she is not in today, so I'm going to do the best I can here really fast to summarize what she had here. As you know, there was a pension reform initiative that was going to be put on the ballot in November of this year, and it has just been taken off the table. The two architects, Carl DeMaio and Chuck Reed from San Jose, drum up the funding to get those on the ballot. So their intent now is to bring that forward in 2018 and try again. So that, for right now, is off the table. This was very interesting. I actually looked at this right before I got into this meeting, and I didn't realize this. Again, this was Don's issue. So a Marin County member of something called the Citizens for Sustainable Pensions filed a writ with the First District Court of Appeals stating that all the past benefit enhancements that Marin County gave to their employees starting in, I believe, 2001 to now, they believe this group feels that they're unconstitutional. And they also feel that the Marin County Board is violating their fiduciary duties by allowing staff to continue to pay these benefits. So they filed this writ, and it was mandated or directed back to the Marin County, or no, the, let me see. The case is now being filed in the Marin County Superior Court. I guess the Court of Appeals said you can't do that here. You got to go through the Superior Court first is what I read. So anyway, I thought that was very interesting. I've never heard of anything like that before, but that's going on out there, and we will definitely keep you informed on what's going on. That's really all I know. I just cursorily read this before I got in here. So
I think conceptually the idea was because that enhanced benefit was not paid for at the time created the tax burden on the taxpayers through an unfunded liability, and that's an unfunded tax, and I think that's the swamp they're trying to get into.
Yeah, and that's part of it. The other part is that they claim that they didn't give the taxpayers fair enough advance warning that they were going to do this to allow the taxpayers to weigh in on these benefit enhancements, which I think that was common in the early 2000s. So.
Interesting.
That's all I have.
So, comment from the group?
None for me.
No
closed session? No. I just want to tell everybody that tomorrow is Enzo Ferrari's birthday.
Good enough.
I'll have pasta in celebration.
Maybe some ravioli or
something. What kind of tire are you wearing today?
Yeah, I was going to. You should have that tomorrow.
This is Ferrari leak. I drive my Ferrari every day through.
Next week's a Maserati week.
That's so egalitarian of the Ferraris.
Hey, let me see your cufflinks.
Oh, these are Ferrari cufflinks.
Nice.
And tomorrow, remember, Enzo Ferrari's birthday.
Sorry, I have a Ford.
I'm sure he has a birthday, too.
Mike?
Nope.
I'm good.
I actually need two volunteers putting out the actuarial RFP at the end of this week, and I'm going to need two people to help with the evaluation of that RFP. I'm not expecting a huge volume of proposals, and so probably in about a month we'll be getting them back in. So I have any volunteers?
One of the reasons I asked Kathy for two is because I need to recuse myself from this, because I have a hunch that everybody that applies I have a relationship or I've had a relationship with in the past. It's a very small world in the actuarial community, and I know pretty much everybody out
Rip
there.
Will be here for the presentation and discussion. But the initial evaluation process, he's going to step back from it. So as they send, all the questions will come in to me, and I will filter everything that comes through, and Rick won't actually see anything until after the initial evaluation is done. If there's any questions I can't answer, Rick will respond to them, but he'll get them blindly. He won't know where they're coming from. So we're going to try to keep this as even level playing field as possible. I still need two volunteers.
Gordo would be really good at that.
Yeah.
Who's ever not
Thank
here?
You, Mandy.
That's Gordo. Sam and Gordo?
Oh, yeah. He gets quick.
Sam
Anybody
loves
else?
To read.
Sam,
too? Sam and Gordo.
Right. Sam and Gordo.
I'll reach out.
I was thinking that actually Mandeep would be a good
choice.
He already
volunteered. I will actually reach out to Sam and Jason. And if neither of them can do it, I'll come back and bother you guys some more.
What is it?
The actuarial.
Reviewing the RFPs?
The proposals.
Before it goes out? Or the ones that we're getting
proposals.
Back in?
No.
Reviewing the RFPs.
reviewing the proposals after they come back in.
When they were investment advisors, each one was about that thick.
Yeah.
This is not going to be that way.
These won't be that many, and there won't be. I'd be thrilled if we got four.
Yes. Part of like the auditors. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll be thrilled if we get four. That's all I have. Thank you.
I have nothing. Great. Okay, then that would be it, and we are.